Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Late in 2018, I met a young Boer, and I was talking to him, and he was telling me how depressed many people are and how sad people are in South Africa. And basically, whites, especially the Afrikaans-speaking whites, were feeling as if they had no value, as if they were just a bunch of losers. And this guy was somebody who was one of the few Afrikaans people on my website. And then I said to him, but you know, we whites, we aren't losers. We whites in Southern Africa, we might not be many, but we're definitely not losers. And in the past, when we ruled, we punched way above our weight level. And I started mentioning various things that had happened in the past, and he knew none of it at all, because he'd been schooled under black rule, and they have no clue. They are not taught their history. It's the same as American children and Canadian children who are being indoctrinated by a bunch of liberal claptrap about their past. So the past that they learn about is pure propaganda and bears no relation to the reality. And so you have a whole generation of young adults growing up and they haven't got a clue about what happened even 20 years ago. I'm not joking. So we got talking and the idea came up that maybe I could do some kind of talk here in South Africa, and maybe I could give the talk at a couple of places and people would be interested and maybe more people would want such talks. So I worked on this thing for quite a while at the end of 2018 into 2019. And I gave it at one place in the Free State, in the Orange Free State here in South Africa. After that, I gave this talk in the eastern part of Johannesburg, and I had quite a nice audience there, and that was pretty much as good as it got. Otherwise, there weren't many people really interested in seeing this talk, and I think I gave it once or twice to small audiences. But there was a total and utter lack of interest in this talk that I gave. Like I say, the best was in the eastern side of Johannesburg, and also the first talk. I thought it would be uplifting to whites to see what had been done in the past that they didn't know. And I can tell you that the vast majority of what is in this talk, in this lecture of mine, is not even known to whites who live in Southern Africa. So it was a real bummer that nobody here in South Africa was really interested in this. People are just despondent and negative, and they believe that liberalism is forever, etc., etc. But I'd actually put a heck of a lot of work into this talk, and it's actually very long for a normal lecture. But I crammed everything into it that I thought people needed to know. And then something interesting happened. Then somebody in America contacted me and said to me that in April they are going to have a thing called the Fash Bash. And they'd like to invite me to come to the Fash Bash and maybe talk there. So I said to them that I have got this lecture that I've actually prepared, and it does relate to whites and to Southern Africa, and I'm sure that they wouldn't have known anything about it, and that it would be of interest to them. And for the record, the Fash Bash was a celebration of Hitler's 130th birthday. So it was all about whites, and whites who are pro-white, and whites who are truthers, and whites who are racial. So I was very excited to get this chance to go to America and to give this talk at the Fash Bash. But I was also in touch with Paul Fromm in Canada. And Paul Fromm runs CAFE, which is the Canadian Association for Freedom of Expression. And I said to Paul that I'm coming to America for the Fash Bash, and I told him about my lecture, and we started talking about maybe I could get into Canada. But because Canada is so freaking crazy liberal, we kept it a secret. I only told one of the guys from the Fash Bash about it, and he said to me, "You mustn't go. You mustn't go. The Canadians are going to arrest you." So anyway, I continued with my clandestine preparations and I sorted out my visa to Canada. Paul Fromm lives in eastern Canada, and so it's easy to get to him from New York. And so the plan was that once the Fash Bash was over, that I would head out and fly to Canada. And Paul had said to me that if I can make it to Canada, that he would actually take me across Canada and allow me to give my talk at a number of places. And I must tell you, I was over the moon. I have been to America once before, back in 2010, but I had never been to Canada. And to be honest with you, I have never planned to go to Canada, and I'd never thought that in my lifetime I'd ever get to Canada. Never mind get a chance to fly across Canada and actually give my talk at a number of places. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to tell the story of us whites in Southern Africa and our miniature world war that we had here between the 1960s and the 1990s, and the battles that we had that virtually nobody knows about anymore. All the liberal liars and all the old communists are hiding all these important things from the past. So I must tell you that Paul Fromm allowing me to go across Canada with him and giving my talk at various places, sometimes the audiences were small, other times it was pretty nice, it was really nice. But I was very grateful to have a chance to tell my story, to tell the story of us few million whites who live in Southern Africa, and how we fought against communism, and that all these blacks who we fought against, no, they weren't good blacks, they were actually evil scum, and they actually practiced a lot of cruelty even on their own people. They were actually hideously cruel to their own kind, even. Not to mention that they also did hideous and disgusting things to whites. But we whites in Southern Africa, we resisted black rule with every ounce of energy that we could, even though we are a very tiny population. And all of this happened from the 1960s until 1994, when South Africa was handed over to black rule, which in my view was an enormous disaster, and we are still paying the price for it, and it's going to get worse. This particular film footage that you're about to see is from the second talk that I gave in Canada, and I gave this at Paul Fromm's house. And the filming of it is to me the best of the filming of all the talks that I gave. And at the beginning of this, Paul Fromm introduces me, and then I give my talk. So I'm pushed for time, and I have to cram as much as I possibly can into this. And the people that were present as well at this location, they were very knowledgeable. So for me, Canada was really awesome. I really like Canada and I have a soft spot for the Canadians, and I cannot thank Paul Fromm enough for what he did for me and for us. I don't know the exact date that I gave this talk, but it was in early May of 2019. It was definitely in the first or second week of May 2019. So here's the video.
Well, I'm Put from South Africa, from Johannesburg. He's born in Rhodesia. As an adult, went to South Africa. He worked in the IT field for many years, and became politically interested and activated about 20 years ago. He's put out a great many videos on many topics, including World War II. He has a big interest in military history. And he's got quite an interesting talk and visual presentation. So without any further ado, please give him a Hamilton welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor for me to be in Canada. I wasn't even sure if I'd be allowed into Canada. And who knows, there might not be a second time. So it is, for me, it is a great thing to have a chance to speak to Canadians face to face. I never thought I'd get this opportunity. And there are some things I'd like to tell you. So this talk of mine is called The History They Never Taught Us, The Truth That's Been Kept From You. And the talk is going to be 50 years of race war in Southern Africa. The liberals have not been publicizing this too much. And it's from 1960 to 2010. So there's a lot to go through, and we'll discuss it. Okay, my name is Jan Lomprecht. I'm the author of a book called Government by Deception. And in my book, I talk a lot about how communists actually think. Communists in South Africa and Southern Africa, these are black communists. They rule five countries in Southern Africa. South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola are ruled by black communists who were armed and supported by the Soviet Union and by China. And you'll see there's no democracy there. But the lying media has been telling you there's democracy. Anyway, in my book, Government by Deception, I analyzed and showed details of how these people speak and how they talk and how they think. They do not think the way that you imagine they think. They do not think in the way that a liberal tells you they think. They operate in a totally different way, and it's extremely deceptive. And in this talk, we're going to look at five white-controlled nations who fought against black rule. And from there, you'll see how we got to the current situation. And I do want to warn the ladies, there are some really graphic photographs in here. Since the time that I've become an activist, I have known two white leaders of white countries in Southern Africa. The one was Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia. I had a chance to speak to him for a very short time and even interviewed him on radio for a very short time. P.W. Botha I knew about 13 years ago, just before he died. He actually read my book, Government by Deception. He liked it, and he began to phone me, and he used to talk to me sometimes for an hour, and he'd tell me things, and I'd go and I'd write it on my website, because none of the press in South Africa even touched him, even wanted to mention a word about him. And when he read what I wrote after our discussions, he was so impressed with the fact that I didn't twist the facts, I didn't lie, I didn't reinterpret things, that he invited me to stay with him at his house, and I stayed at his house for 5 days, and we had lots of interesting discussions. The liberals will tell you that blacks have been inhabiting Africa for millions of years. But the truth of the matter is that in Southern Africa, blacks are themselves colonizers. The blacks have moved down from West Africa, and they've only done so over the last 2,000 years. In fact, the blacks and the whites met down here in South Africa at the Great Fish River. When the whites landed in the bottom tip of South Africa in 1652, and whites began exploring upwards, they ran into blacks moving downwards. Prior to the blacks, there were other people. They were called Khoi and San, Bushmen. These people are not in any way related to those blacks. And they existed in small, sparse groups all across this terrain. And when the blacks came down, the dark-skinned people that you associate with Southern Africa, they are the colonizers. And when they moved down through Africa, they were murdering and killing all the others in front of them, all the Khoi and so forth. In fact, those Bushmen hated them so much that when there was a war later, the Bushmen fought on the side of apartheid South Africa. So, and just another thing about these blacks, you think that they've inhabited this area for millions of years, but actually they only beat the whites there by a couple of centuries. And the Zulus, the biggest, most famous tribe in South Africa, the Zulus can only trace their own lineage back to 1670, which is after 1652 when the whites were already in Southern Africa. The whites of South Africa suffer from a tremendous guilt complex. They have been led to believe, in many ways like the Germans, that they're the most hideous whites who've ever walked on the face of the earth. They've been led to believe that they've killed millions of people and that they're the most hideous whites on the planet. And you've heard nothing but endless stories about apartheid, its cruelty, and what a evil, horrid system it is. The reality, however, is a lot different. They will never tell you about the truly greatest genocide that ever occurred in Southern Africa, in South Africa itself. In the 1800s, the Zulus went on the attack, attacking other black tribes, and it kicked off a whole bunch of wars. And there was an offshoot of the Zulus called the Ndebele, led by a chief called Mzilikazi. And they went into the center of South Africa. When they went there, Mzilikazi told them to kill all the black people in the center of South Africa. In a period of a couple of years, they killed between 1 and 2 million black people. But you never hear about this genocide. This is the greatest genocide that ever took place. You never hear them asking the Zulus for reparations. Nothing. In order to understand how the race wars came about in Southern Africa, you have to understand what the world was like at the end of World War II. That map that you see there, those countries that are highlighted in Africa, that is the British Empire at the end of World War II. But at the end of World War II, the British were bankrupt. The British had shipped all their gold from South Africa to America to pay off war loans, which they only finished paying off in 2006. And the Russians, who had been built up by America, by Britain, by the rich, Russia had decided that they were going to conquer the world, but they specifically wanted to destroy all the empires of Europe. And at the top of their list was the British Empire. So the allies of the British decided that they were going to destroy them. And that is what kicked off a lot of big things. Now, in Southern Africa, the Russians specifically saw that Southern Africa was exceptionally rich in minerals. And they regarded Southern Africa as the mineral storehouse of the world. The sort of Middle East, but the Middle East of minerals and true wealth. And they wanted to seize Southern Africa, especially South Africa. Even now, in 2019, the untapped mineral wealth of South Africa is $43 trillion. So after World War II, suddenly the British were faced with all this agitation that started coming across their empire from the Asians, from the blacks, and so forth. But this agitation was actually sponsored by the Soviets and the Chinese. They were actually creating revolution all across the British Empire. In some places, it broke out into outright war. The first war was in Kenya in 1952, and this is the first time that truly horrid terrorism and extreme brutality was used against white people. The Mau Mau were extremely brutal. They even chopped people's arms and legs off with machetes. They even chopped off, chop the legs of animals, etc. The British fought in Kenya until 1960. And then another war broke out, a war that you could call Britain's Vietnam, but nobody ever advertises it like that. And Britain's Vietnam is Malaysia. And what happened in Malaysia is that communist terrorists started moving into Malaysia, and the British brought in others from the other parts of the British Empire, including Rhodesia, to come and fight. And they fought there from 1948 until 1960. Now, just to give you an idea of how hard it was to fight terrorism in those days, I just want to tell you about an operation that the British did that was regarded as a success. In one operation called Nassau, the British fired 60,000 artillery shells, 30,000 rounds of mortar ammunition, and they dropped 2,000 bombs. And all that they got for their effort was they killed or captured 35 terrorists. And the British could see that this kind of warfare, this communist terrorism, these terrorists armed with Soviet and Chinese weapons operating in this guerrilla manner, they're not going to beat them. And I suspect that the British must have realized they're going to lose their entire empire. There's no ways in hell they're going to be able to defend this empire. Because all of a sudden, you'll see in 1960, the Prime Minister of Britain went to the Parliament in Cape Town and he gave a speech known as the Winds of Change speech. And that speech basically said, it's time to leave and abandon all these countries and give them all independence. And it was also a message to the whites of Southern Africa, your time is up. Britain is pulling out. So the British then, after 1960, in the next couple of years, they dumped their entire empire. They suddenly gave everybody independence, regardless of what they were. And then they created the Commonwealth, and they tried to get sort of diplomatic and financial hooks into what used to be their empire. But they abandoned that empire. They had no intention of fighting anymore. Also in the 1950s, as these blacks were starting to agitate for independence in southern Rhodesia and northern Rhodesia, these blacks were starting to agitate, and the whites who lived there decided to try to make it more pleasant for the blacks. And so they engaged in a liberal experiment known as the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. They took three African countries under the rule of southern Rhodesia, and they tried to speed up the development of the blacks, and even to give blacks positions as junior ministers and things, in the hope that if we help the blacks to develop faster and we give them more opportunities, then the blacks will not just want to break away and go communist. However, this whole thing flopped. This thing flopped, and after 10 years, the blacks said they're not interested, they want their own countries. A little known fact about South Africa. South Africa's got the second oldest communist party in the world. The first communist party formed outside of the Soviet Union itself was formed in South Africa in 1921. That communist party was run by whites. Whites and Jews, they ran this communist party. And they were only interested in white communists. They were not interested in blacks. So these white communists agitated and worked with the white miners, and they used the white miners' strike as an attempt to create a revolution. And in Johannesburg, there was actual fighting, trenches, artillery, etc. There was a miniature revolution within 6 months of the formation of the South African Communist Party, and the government had to come in and kill the rebels and hang the communists and so forth. But anyway, when that failed, the white communists still continued, and they allowed non-whites into the Communist Party. But this ultimately backfired on them. Among the non-whites who joined them was that guy on the far left, James Laguma. He was a colored guy, and this guy was the head of the African National Congress, who rules South Africa today. He was the head of it at the time, and he also joined the South African Communist Party. These two non-whites went off to Moscow in 1927, and Laguma spoke to the Russians, and he said, why don't we turn South Africa into a black republic? And the Russians really liked the idea. And the Russians gave the order to the white communists the next year. They said, you've got to work towards South Africa being a black republic, a black communist republic, of course. And to this day, in South African politics, there is an actual formal alliance that exists between the South African Communist Party, which exists to this day, between the South African Communist Party and the African National Congress, who run the country. They are the official, they are the most popular party in the country. And the other part of it is COSATU, which is a trade union, basically a communist trade union. This alliance is known as the Tripartite Alliance. Those three entities work together. And communists from the South African Communist Party can stand in elections as ANC candidates. They have stood and they have won and they have entered parliament. So that relationship has existed now for close to 100 years. And nobody talks about it. So once the British abandoned their empire, one part of their empire that still existed in southern Africa was Rhodesia, southern Rhodesia. And the whites who lived there were told, you've got to hand over your country to the blacks. But the whites who lived there were not that keen on the idea. And the whites of Rhodesia resisted this idea. And in 1965, the small population of whites in Rhodesia, they were just over 200,000, they rebelled against Britain. And they declared what was called UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. It's the same thing that I think the Irish did in 1916 and the same thing the Americans did in 1776. This is Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, who declared UDI. And here's a little place where he says that blacks should not be allowed to rule Rhodesia, not even in 1,000 years.
I don't believe in black majority rule ever in Rhodesia, not in 1,000 years.
So the Liberals like to take him apart for that, and here is where a Liberal asks them about it.
Once upon a time, Prime Minister, you said you would never see black rule in this country in your lifetime. Do you still stand by that?
Yes, I believe that that was a fair comment. I think that if we ever got to a stage of having black rule, then I think our policy would have failed.
Well, and as you will see, the whites tried to accommodate these blacks using all kinds of tricks. Anyway, the British Prime Minister immediately put sanctions on the country, got the United Nations. They put Rhodesia under possibly the most complete sanctions that any country has ever experienced, maybe in all of history. We weren't allowed to buy weapons. We weren't allowed to trade. We couldn't buy or sell anything at all. And the Royal Navy even used to intercept oil tankers that were bringing oil to Rhodesia, and they'd intercept them and turn them away. The Prime Minister of England, Wilson, is quoted as saying the following: the cumulative effects of the economic and financial sanctions might well bring the rebellion to an end within a matter of weeks rather than months. The truth is the whites hung in there for 14 years, including a bitter war. These are photographs I took of fuel rationing coupons from when I was a kid. This is what my parents had. At times there was enough fuel, at other times there wasn't enough fuel, and then the government would issue these fuel rationing coupons, and you could only buy a liter of fuel if you had a coupon that authorized you to. And I think petrol back then cost 5 cents a liter. This plane looks like it's an Arabian or Middle Eastern plane. But this plane is actually a Rhodesian plane, and the Rhodesians tried to engage in what they called sanctions busting. They decided to try and trade with other countries illegally, and they had planes like these that would go to Europe, and they'd load up stuff, and they'd try and strike deals with Europeans, and often they were quite successful. Now, One aspect of the war in Southern Africa was that Portugal was the only European country that decided to fight for its colonial empire in Africa. And Portugal had three territories in Africa, but we're only going to concern ourselves with the two in Southern Africa. The one is Mozambique, the other one is Angola. Now, when you look at these five different white-controlled countries, although they were white supremacist and only whites could vote, they still had some different rules in them. They weren't all exactly the same. At the one end of the scale, you had the South Africans with apartheid, where interracial marriage was outright illegal. But at the other end of the scale, you had the Portuguese, who had a system called the assimilado system. And under this system, white men could fraternize with black women, they could have children with them, they could marry them. The races could intermingle. And if you listen to the modern lying liberals, you will believe that this is a system that will result in less hatred between the races. However, in the case of the Portuguese, the most brutal race war that ever took place in Southern Africa in terms of utter brutality took place between them and the blacks. Now, in Mozambique, which was their territory on the east coast of Southern Africa, you had the Chinese building bases in Tanzania, training terrorists, arming them with communist weapons, and they would move down into Mozambique, and the Portuguese would fight and try and hold them out. The war in Mozambique was something of a stalemate for the Portuguese, but the cooperation between the Portuguese and the other whites of Southern Africa was excellent. And Rhodesia also had a thing called hot pursuit, when they chased terrorists and hunted them, and they'd sometimes chase them all the way into Mozambique. And the Portuguese allowed us to just send our army into Mozambique. We didn't have to request permission. If we were in hot pursuit, we could hunt them down, shoot who we needed to shoot, and cooperation was absolutely excellent. Just as a fun note, later when the Portuguese war in Africa collapsed, there were Portuguese who said that Mozambique should be cut in half and that the southern part of Mozambique should actually unite with Rhodesia and South Africa into a single state. And unfortunately, it was an idea that was never pursued. But Ian Smith liked the idea a lot. Here are some very rough casualty statistics from the war in Mozambique. The Portuguese statistics are very hard to come by, and I'm still doing more digging. But this is the best that I can find at this point in time. That blue chart there shows you the number of Frelimo. These are communist terrorists. These are communist terrorists in their army that were fighting the Portuguese. The Portuguese had an army that built up to 50,000. But the brown shows the number of people actually killed in battle. So the Portuguese didn't have many killed in battle, and they killed maybe about 10,000 terrorists in battle. The civilians, large numbers of black civilians were killed, and it's hard to say exactly who killed most of them. Often the communist terrorists were actually the ones who killed black civilians more than the whites. It's a topic we'll revisit. The other war that occurred, also in the period 61 to 74, was Angola, a much larger territory, much richer, very important for the Portuguese. Portuguese wanted to hang on to Angola at all costs. And in Angola, some of the most brutal race war in the history of Southern Africa took place. And it started in March 1961, in the north of Angola. There was a black commander who decided to form large armies and let these blacks try and just overwhelm the whites and just slaughter every white they could lay their hands on. And they went and they killed farmers, they killed whites and small outposts, and they did that sort of thing. And in this attack, there were even places where they grabbed whites and they put them through sawmills alive and sawed them in half. And the atrocities that come out of Angola and Mozambique that the Portuguese tell are among the most brutal that you'll ever find. There are instances where blacks cut open white pregnant women, cut them open, and even pulled their babies out and cut their babies' heads off. The most gruesome things that ever took place between blacks and whites took place in the Portuguese territories. But when these blacks attacked southwards and they were wiping out the farms, they got to a little town of 5,000 whites who had 28 troops. And the Portuguese army was unable to get to that town in time to prevent the black attack. And so that evening, 30,000 blacks came and attacked this town. They had various weapons. Some were well-armed, others were not. And these 30,000 blacks attacked these 5,000 whites, who defended with whatever they could lay their hands on. In the fighting that took place, the whites managed to kill probably thousands of blacks that night. There were white casualties, I don't know how many. And this is where the blacks had their whole attack brought to a halt. And after that attack, the blacks never, ever, ever tried to use mass attacks on whites in southern Africa ever again. They never tried it again. However, they had so angered the Portuguese that the Portuguese then went on a counterattack. When these blacks had attacked the Portuguese, they had also killed blacks who were friendly to the Portuguese. And they'd slaughtered other blacks as well in large number. So 6,000 Portuguese, along with 6,000 black troops on their side, these groups went and they engaged in a counter-genocide. They spent the next 2 months going and just killing any blacks that they got their hands on, women, children, they wiped out villages, etc. In a period of about 2 months, they killed between 20 and 30,000 blacks. In the original genocidal attack, I'm not sure of the exact casualties, but it could be as few as 500 whites who were killed, maybe as many as 7,000. I'm not quite sure of the statistics. But the counter-genocide, the whites killed at least 20,000, if not more. As the war progressed, the Portuguese went on to win the war in Angola. There were three black communist armies. They eventually defeated three of the four, and they eventually smashed them. And by 1974, they literally had the whole of the country under control. And the Portuguese also had black special forces called Fletchers. Another thing the Portuguese did in their colonies was they allowed whites from Europe to emigrate to Africa, and they encouraged it. And so you can see the Portuguese population in Angola went up from 1960 to 1974. And eventually their population reached 400,000. This is the second highest white population of whites in any country in southern Africa. The only country with more whites than this was South Africa itself. It's hard to get accurate statistics of the war in Angola, but the Portuguese possibly lost about 2,500 troops killed in action. They killed at least about 10,000 black terrorists. But with all those other slaughters that went on, it could be the most brutal battle, the most brutal race war that was ever fought in southern Africa, possibly with total casualties being close to 100,000 people. This will give you an idea of some of the brutality of these black communists. The communists, the Soviets and the Chinese, they taught the blacks to be absolutely cruel and ruthless and brutal in any way whatsoever. And they killed their own kind. You can see this is from Angola. They killed blacks. They even decapitated them. This photo on the left, it shows black communist terrorists in North Angola being trained and armed with the latest Soviet weaponry. Here are children being taught how to use hand grenades. And I just want to tell you, all these liberals, they tell you that this is democracy in southern Africa and human rights and blah, blah, blah. But if you actually dig into it, in the 1980s, there was another civil war among the blacks, a huge civil war that took place. And in that civil war, the communists used black children as young as 14 years old in battle. And in the 1980s in South Africa itself, I was working with blacks who lived in Soweto, and they were telling me that the ANC was issuing handguns to children maybe as young as 12, even younger, and they used those weapons to intimidate adults. Nobody talks about those things anymore. Another thing that occurred in the time of the Portuguese Wars is the following. If you look at that chart, you'll see that the GDP of Angola in the period 62 to 1970, during the time of this low-intensity war, the GDP more than doubled. And the same is true for Mozambique. The GDP more than doubled during the time of this low-intensity war. And of course, remember that whites were also moving in. And the per capita income, the income per person, was actually improving. The standard of living was actually going up while the war was raging. And this is actually a thing that happened in Rhodesia as well and in South Africa. In these low-intensity wars, things were not actually getting worse. The way that the war in the way that the Portuguese war ended was due to a thing called the Carnation Revolution. It was something of a coup d'etat that happened in Portugal in 1974. And I just want to mention a bit about the year 1974. These wars that had started in the early 1960s, from that time until 1974, all the whites of southern Africa were winning. The Portuguese were winning. In Mozambique, it was maybe a stalemate. In Angola, they'd won outright. In Rhodesia, they were down to maybe 100 black terrorists in the bush. In South Africa and Southwest Africa, there was absolutely no resistance to white rule. The whites dominated completely. 13 years into the race, into this communist-inspired race war, and the whites were winning everywhere. And then suddenly, the first of a number of political moves that destroyed the whites. The whites of Southern Africa were not destroyed through warfare. They were destroyed through politics. And this was the first of the political moves that destroyed them. Suddenly, there was this coup d'etat in Portugal. A general came to power. I've come across information that it might even have been inspired by the KGB itself. And suddenly, this general came to power, and suddenly he stopped all the wars and gave all the countries independence immediately. And it was a disaster for the Portuguese who lived in Africa. The Frelimo who took over Mozambique on the east coast, they nationalized every single business in the country. And the bank accounts of the whites in Angola and Mozambique were frozen. The Portuguese fled from their own territories of Mozambique and Angola. They literally fled with their shirts on their backs. They fled either to Southwest Africa or to Rhodesia or to South Africa itself. When I was a kid, Portuguese were coming into Rhodesia and they left everything behind, their homes, everything. They were so afraid that the blacks might try to kill them again. And for the rest of the whites of Southern Africa, this was a huge disaster. For the whites of Rhodesia, it opened up 1,000 kilometers of border that we now had to protect. I just want to show you some evidence of the Russians in Southern Africa. This is the African National Congress. They rule South Africa currently. They used to have rallies in South Africa in the 1980s, and they openly used the flag of the Soviet Union in South Africa. Here is the Rhodesian army in Zambia in the 1970s. And there on this building that in this camp, you can see the hammer and sickle of the Soviets having been painted by the blacks. Here is a photo of black officers from Angola dealing with Russians. They're walking in a street in Russia. And here are Cubans and Russians teaching blacks in Angola about communism. And there are the photographs of Marx and Lenin on the walls. And here is a Russian soldier captured by South Africa in Angola in 1981. Let's take a look at the Rhodesian Bush War. The Rhodesian Bush War started in 1964, before UDI. But in the first 2 years of the war was secret. The Central Intelligence Organization, which was like our CIA, actually infiltrated every single terrorist group that was coming from Zambia, every single terrorist group that had been armed by the communists and trained and sent to Rhodesia, just disappeared. They were just never heard from again. And it turned out that for 2 years, the CIO was infiltrating them all and killing them all, and nobody knew anything about it. In 1968, a group of terrorists got into Rhodesia, and a white commander decided to kill them using air power, and this became known as the Battle of Sonoya. And this was the first time ever that the whites and blacks, in public, knew that there was some kind of fighting going on. Even so, with these all these events, including the Battle of Sonoya, the blacks were so demoralized that for the next 4 years, they did not attack Rhodesia at all. I come from Boers who lived in Rhodesia, and Boers in Rhodesia were actually a minority of the white population. Rhodesia was English-speaking, mostly people of British descent, and the Afrikaans speakers were about 15% of the population. However, they fitted in with the English, and they went on to support the war against the blacks without a problem. That guy you see on the left, his name is Marius Marais. He's an Afrikaans guy. He was used in a recruiting poster for the Rhodesian Light Infantry. This guy here is called Wayne Honnekom. He's Afrikaans. He was used as the model for a statue called the Troopie, and this is a statue to the fallen dead of Rhodesia. These current rulers of Southern Africa, here's another little dark secret about them that they don't tell you. This cartoon from South Africa actually is about an event that occurred quite a lot in Southern Africa. These blacks, the black terrorists, would come into either what is now Namibia, which was then Southwest Africa, or Rhodesia, and they would come to a school where there were black children. And these communist terrorists would come with their weapons, and they'd abduct an entire school of black children all at once, and they'd march them off across the border to go for military training. And the African National Congress, which rules South Africa now, they used to have a slogan called liberation before education. They were not concerned about education. Let me tell you a little bit about how so-called democracy came to Southern Africa. Democracy, communist style. When these blacks were trained by the Russians and the Chinese, and they went and used their various lies and propaganda to try and convert other blacks to communism, if those blacks did not fall for the lies or did not buy into the idea of communism, the way that they then got people to change their minds was by inflicting physical pain on them. So that's how communist democracy works. You don't need to have a better argument than somebody. If you hurt somebody enough, you will change their political viewpoint. And this is an example of it. Here are blacks who were friendly to the whites, and the communists went in Rhodesia and they herded them into that hut, which used to have a thatched roof. They set it on fire and they burned all those blacks to death. So this is just an example of what they do to what they regard as race traitors. Blacks who were friendly to us were regarded by them as race traitors, and they inflicted on them some hideous experiences. The guy on the left, this is a typical example of how these terrorists worked out in the rural areas. They might be at a village, and they discover that there's a black guy in the village who's friendly to the whites. So what they do is they call all the villagers together, and they then take this guy in front of the villagers, and they say to the villagers, "This guy is a traitor, and we're going to show you what we do to traitors." And so what they did in the case of this guy was they cut his flesh off, his lips and part of his ears. They cut it off him alive, and they gave it to his wife, and she had to cook it, and she had to eat it in front of the whole tribe. So that is how they showed them, this is what we do to traitors. This guy you see here, his lips were cut off. Here were other blacks who were working for white farmers. They were tied up and shot by the communist terrorists. Christians, Christian missionaries in Africa, they were also attacked by these communists. They came and they slaughtered them. And these are British missionaries who were killed in Rhodesia. And that's a three-week-old white baby also killed by the terrorists. The Soviets came up with the idea that maybe they should try to shoot down some civilian airliners containing whites. And so that is what happened in this case. In these planes that you see here, that is a Viscount. That was a common civilian airliner in Rhodesia back then. In 1978, they had terrorists with Soviet weaponry, and they shot down a plane called the Hanyani with 52 passengers and 4 crew. When it crashed on the ground, there were 18 whites who survived. But the terrorists had known more or less where the plane would crash, and they had terrorists on the ground waiting to look for survivors, and they massacred 10 of the 18 whites who had survived the crash. However, the Rhodesian army hunted down these terrorists and killed them within a week. Another instance was the Amniati, which was shot down, but when that plane crashed in the bush, it broke up so badly that everybody was killed. This is what the Hanyani looked like when it crashed in the African bush. In my book, Government by Deception, I talk about a plane, a Boeing 747 Combi, that crashed very mysteriously in the Indian Ocean in 1987. I give my reasons why I believe that the KGB probably put an incendiary device on that plane and almost 300 whites were killed. In this little video that you're going to see survivors from the Hanyani talking about their experience.
Minutes after the Viscount Hanyani was airborne, a Russian-supplied SAM-7 missile struck the aircraft whilst it was still climbing.
I think we over Karori, that's where you were born. And bang, the engine were hit and fire came out of the engine.
Red instant fire on the starboard engine. Big fire flames coming right back past even the last windows.
And we could actually feel the heat from inside.
It must have taken us 4 or 5 minutes to get from the height we were down to ground level.
I'm not ready for dying yet, so just let's focus on that. You're not ready for dying.
The fire was still burning pretty strongly, and I thought that we had no chance of even reaching the ground. I thought that wing would fall off long before we got near the ground.
Looking back at it, and even at the time, they handled it as well as anybody could do.
Somebody was trying to open one of the escape windows. But the hostesses were very good.
And I could see the treetops coming closer and closer, and I thought to myself, he may make it somehow.
The last thing the pilot said to us was, brace yourselves for impact.
It was like being in a cement mixer. It was quite dark, I would think, because of the dust. And
we bounced for a short while, and then there was just a terrific impact. Fantastic noise, and we were rolling.
There was metal flying all over the place. I would think a lot of people were killed on impact.
It felt a bit like I should imagine one would feel if you were thrown into a concrete mixer. The same sort of noise and same sort of feeling. We seemed to roll for a long time, and suddenly we were still.
Didn't know how the plane had actually landed, but later I found out that it was, at the time it was when I realized that I was trapped inside the plane, and
the
lying upside down.
I thought, I've got to get out. This thing's going to burn. I could actually see flames from where I was. And I tried to head for the only little bit of daylight I could see, and discovered my seatbelt was still done up, and I got that off.
There was a lady on fire who gave me her child and asked me to take the child out, which I did. We eventually got a few people out.
There was no severe panic in the plane. People behaved very calmly and very dignified, I would say, knowing that we were heading for death. And that's the time I saw Tony opening up a little crack in the fuselage. And I went to help him, and we managed to open that crack sufficiently to get out.
There was one poor chap stuck fairly near the hole, and his legs were jammed, and we couldn't get him out, and the fire was getting fiercer and fiercer all the time, and the fire was right near the hole that we were all getting out of.
So those are the eight whites who survived the first crash. Because these terrorists were attacking and using the utmost brutality against blacks who were friendly to the whites had to try and do things to protect the blacks, even though the whites were a small population themselves. On this map that you see from 1978, the green and the red areas, this is what is known as a TTL, a tribal trust land. It's almost like the Bantustans of South Africa, but not quite the same. It's a place where only the blacks live, and they live in their villages there. And the whites built more than 172 new villages and moved more than 350,000 blacks to these new villages. And these villages were designed for protection, and the whites trained blacks, trained and armed blacks, to try and defend themselves against the communist terrorists. This protected village system was very expensive. The Portuguese also did the same thing in Mozambique. When the war resumed in Rhodesia, you may have heard of farm attacks in South Africa, but the most brutal farm attacks in the history of Southern Africa occurred against the white farmers in Rhodesia. And these attacks resumed in 1972. And this photo you see is of a farmhouse that had come under attack. The terrorists operated in groups of between 10 to 30, and all of them had AK-47s. There'd be at least one in every group of 10 who'd have a machine gun. They could have hand grenades. They could have RPG-7s. RPG is a rocket-propelled grenade. It's an anti-tank weapon. They could even have mortars. And they would attack a farmhouse where the farmer and his wife and his children were living. The farmers put multiple fences around their farms. Sometimes they even used sandbags. They had dogs. They would put wire mesh over the windows. And then these blacks would come and they'd attack at night. The Rhodesian Army and Air Force didn't have night fighting capability. We were quite backward in that sense. But they did have a radio system, and the farmers could call for help and notify farmers and government that they're under attack. However, the farmer and his wife have to stay in their house all night, and they have to fight off these terrorists as best they can. So what you see here are the bullet holes from the AK-47s and machine guns hitting the walls. But notice the bullets don't go through the brick walls. But there where the arrow is, that's where an RPG-7 actually punched a hole through the wall. So it goes straight through the wall, and then it explodes on the inside. The wire mesh across the windows helps to stop hand grenades coming into the house. And in the morning, the terrorists do their attacks at night, and then late at night they then start running and hiding and getting away, because in the morning the Rhodesian Army is going to engage in hot pursuit. To my knowledge, I stand to be corrected, but to my knowledge, I don't think anybody ever actually died in such an attack. And if anybody did die, it was very few. There were many instances of people being injured from flying glass and shrapnel, but I don't think anybody ever actually died in an attack on such a farmhouse. The whites in Southern Africa used all kinds of dirty tricks in order to fight back. That thing you're looking at there, that's a book bomb. The Rhodesians sent that to some terrorists in Zambia and killed the second in charge of a group there. The Portuguese also used parcel bombs. The South Africans also used various bombs, including parcel bombs. The top communist in Southern Africa was a Jew by the name of Joe Slovo. He was said to be a colonel in the KGB. South Africa sent a parcel bomb, but his wife, Ruth First, opened it and she was blown away. South Africa later created car bombs and did other dirty tricks in Southern Africa. A rather strange unit that came out of Rhodesia is known as the Sulu Scouts. And this is what the Sulu Scouts looked like. They were an elite force, And basically the concept behind the Sulu Scouts was to use blacks to catch other blacks. And the guys, if you look on the left, you'll see there are whites and blacks in the Sulu Scouts. And those blacks are actually blacks who used to be communists whom we captured. And then if we believed that they could be of use to us, there would be some of them that we would offer them the chance to fight on our side, and they did. And so these blacks, having been captured and now working for us, now help our white soldiers to go back and hunt down and kill their former colleagues. And so what you had was you had two-man teams of blacks and whites, and the whites would put on a cream to look black, and the blacks and whites would go into the bush, and they'd go trying to hunt down these other black terrorists. Now, the way that these pseudo operations worked was the Rhodesian government would use the Sulu Scouts in areas where there was a lot of terrorist activity. So what they would do is they would take that entire area and they would freeze the area. And by freezing it, no police, no army, nobody from government is allowed to go there, because nobody's going to know who are the real terrorists and who are our terrorists, the Sulu Scouts. And so the Sulu Scouts would go into this area and they would stay there for a long period of time, and they would sneak around and they would try to meet up with other terrorists, trick them, ambush them, try and attack them, try and poison them, or call the Air Force in to come and kill them. These guys that you see in this photograph, these guys that you see here, only one is actually black, and it's the guy down in the bottom left corner. These others are whites. These are Sulu Scouts. And these Sulu Scouts actually are on an operation outside Rhodesia. Now, the whites became pretty good, as you saw with the British. To fight these small groups and hunt them down is very difficult, very difficult. We didn't have satellites, we didn't have the kind of technology that America has and so forth. So it's very hard. And also the war in Angola, Mozambique, and Rhodesia was a lot like Vietnam. Lots of what you could call jungle. South Africa and Southwest Africa are flatter and semi-desert, whole different terrain. But in those areas, you had to hunt through the bush to try and find these terrorists. And it was very expensive to fight these small groups. So despite the entire world always condemning us and trying to make life difficult for us, the fact of the matter was that eventually a commander decided that it really would help if we could try and attack some of these big communist bases. Because these communists are just across the border, and they come and they attack, and then they flee back, and then they're safe. And then they just carry on with their nonsense. So eventually, the leader of the Sulu Scouts decided to try and launch a cross-border raid. The government denied him air cover, and the government was going to totally deny that these were soldiers from Rhodesia doing it. And this was the first of what you could call the big battles. And this thing which the Rhodesians developed was later brought to its sort of greatest extent and perfection by the South Africans. And these big battles became winners for us. We would attack them. And in this video that you're about to see, there's also a black guy called Edgar Tekere near the end. And if you listen very carefully, he says, "How did you guys manage to knock us so flat where it hurts?" Because this caught the blacks completely by surprise.
These are the mass graves of hundreds of men, women, and children killed by the Rhodesian army in one morning. Their camp had first been identified by a Rhodesian reconnaissance flight.
On his way home, he saw a gap in the clouds. They came through it, and right below him, fortuitously, was the camp, which the navigator snapped quickly. They blew it up so they could actually count the heads, and there were 800 terrorist groups, as we call them, formed up in a hollow square being addressed by their commander on the parade ground.
Over the next few weeks, the camp was kept under surveillance as its population grew to an estimated 5,000.
In August 1976, Reed Daly decided it was time to strike. 70 Sulu scouts would cross the Mozambique border and drive into the Nyadzonia camp disguised as guerrillas. They'd kidnap the commanders and destroy the camp. Reed Daly asked General Walls for his approval.
He unrolled all the maps on the floor, and he whistled in his teeth, and he looked at me, and he said, hell of a risk, yeah. And I said to him, it'll work, because that's the last thing I expect.
At 8 in the morning, the force swirled into the camp. Their disguise was so effective that they were mobbed by a cheering crowd, but someone spotted that masked troops in the back of one truck were white.
So the column commander gave the word to fire. It was like a scythe going through a cornfield. They just went down like flies.
A lot of them laid injured and screaming, okay? I remember one girl, she was also injured, and she was crying. She came from my home area, and it touched me, and after that, I didn't want to think about it.
Our casualties were 4 lightly wounded, and they were over 1,000. The exact was 1,026.
Killed.
I mean, war, you work on, for one kill, there's always at least 2 wounded. So there were a couple of thousand others who should have been running around with what we call oil leaks, you know.
I've never forgotten the kind of sight I saw there. I think they must have emptied some tons of ammunition, judging by the shells that gathered that almost half an acre or more of a camp, empty shells, for a really massacre.
This was a good hit, and it certainly put Zandla back a long, long way.
It was played up as the usual way of being a refugee camp by the people on that side and by the United Nations. But I do believe that it was a justifiable military target.
Hickman's view is accepted by one of Mugabe's top commanders.
So you don't have a complaint about the principle of Nyadzonia being attacked?
No. As a soldier, talking to me as a soldier. Oh, yes. All I can see, like I was saying to General Walls, I said, how did you manage to knock us so flat? You really knocked us way too much, militarily.
Nyadzonia was followed by ferocious assaults on other guerrilla bases. They tested the resilience of Mugabe's forces to the limit.
So that was the first external battle. In the wars in Mozambique, Angola, and Rhodesia, a lot of the fighting took place away from the cities, out in the rural areas, like I say, forested, etc. The roads were gravel, and there were lots of trees and things, and the terrorists could be on either side of the road with machine guns and RPGs, and they'd try and attack you. And this is an example of Rhodesian anti-ambush devices. Those are actually shotgun barrels, and if this vehicle comes under an attack, then the driver pulls the lever and then all the barrels fall down and they blast out on the sides. And the purpose is just to fire back and try and get out of the killing ground. And this is the same principle applied to a civilian vehicle. Now, a very important weapon that was used in these wars was the Soviet and Chinese anti-tank landmines. An anti-tank landmine is designed to blow the tracks off of a tank. But if you dig that into the ground and you let a civilian vehicle hits that thing, it'll blow it to shreds. And they also used anti-personnel mines on paths. And if you hit an anti-personnel mine, it will blow your foot or your leg off. And notice also, these are indiscriminate killers. They kill whites, they kill blacks, they kill anybody. But the communists didn't care. So that is what a civilian vehicle looks like after it's hit a anti-tank landmine. And this family of whites, these were killed in South Africa. I think the whole family was in a car that hit a landmine. You can see what a landmine does to you. This is an 80-seater bus. This was the main transport system of the blacks in those days. And an 80-seater bus full of blacks hits a landmine and stacks of them are killed. The Portuguese also struggled with landmines, and to find the landmines, they had people walking in front of the vehicles prodding the ground. It's a very slow, tedious process, and in this case, they found a box landmine. So the Rhodesians began to experiment because the landmines were such a big problem. They tried to start inventing ways to survive landmine blasts, and this is one of the first vehicles that came out. It's called a Leopard, and the first principle is that the bottom of it is a V-shape of strengthened steel to deflect the blast. Then the wheels are pushed as far away from the vehicle as possible, also to get distance for the blast. And the blast might also just rip the wheels off without affecting the rest of the vehicle too much. And there are roll bars in case the vehicle rolls so that it doesn't crush the occupants. And of course, the people need to be wearing seat belts as well. So this is a Hyena, a mine-proof vehicle, and I'm going to show you what happens when it hits a landmine. There's a Hyena on the left. The front wheel hit the landmine, and despite the damage, the compartment where the people are in, they are safe. In this case, this one's been completely flipped onto upside down, and still the people would be able to survive. The Rhodesian secret weapon to fight the landmine was this tiny vehicle. It was called the Pookie. The idea behind the Pookie was to develop a vehicle that could actually drive over an anti-tank landmine without setting it off. And so they came up with the idea to use Formula One racing tires and this tiny vehicle driven by only one guy. And they tried to make the vehicle that could actually drive over the landmine without having enough pressure to set it off. And then they had metal detectors in the middle. And this little vehicle worked extremely well. It would drive in front of a convoy at speeds of up to 80 kilometers an hour hunting for landmines. South Africa did even more advanced stuff with anti-landmine vehicles. That vehicle on the left is South Africa's version of the Pookie. This vehicle is called in Afrikaans a Spinnekop, which means spider. It's a special kind of mine-detecting vehicle that South Africans invented. For the whites of Southern Africa, helicopters were critical for our survival. And the country that comes up the most when it relates to the whites of Southern Africa is France. The French actually helped us the most in order to survive. And in the case of South Africa, they had these Puma helicopters, military helicopters that you see on the left. That's a French military helicopter. But the South Africans also invested a lot of money in these French Alouette 3s. These are civilian helicopters. And these civilian helicopters actually became one of the most important weapons in our survival, even though it's not meant for combat. So this is what an Alouette is like in the Rhodesian Air Force once it's got its machine guns. It can't carry many troops, but you can see the few troops that it can carry. It carries about 4 troops along with the gunner and pilot, and then those troops can jump off. So that one on the left is an Alouette armed with twin machine guns. And this one on the right is an Alouette armed with a 20mm cannon. And the 20mm cannon fires explosive rounds. When it hits the ground, it explodes. Very deadly. And these vehicles were referred to as G-cars or K-cars. I think K was for kill, something like that. The Rhodesian Air Force only had 8 of these helicopters. But South Africa lent us 42. along with the crews to fly them. Later, South Africa withdrew the crews, and these helicopters were flown just by Rhodesians. But these were the most critical combat vehicles of all. Here are Rhodesian paratroopers using old Dakotas. We also had a couple of old jets. We used to be a British colony, so we used jets that came from Britain that we purchased before our rebellion. This was our most advanced aircraft, the Hawker Hunter, and it couldn't go supersonic, but it was our most useful ground attack aircraft. We also used Canberra bombers. South Africa also used Canberra bombers. They were our long-range bombers to bomb the bases of the blacks. This little plane that you see in front of you, this is known as a Cessna Skymaster, and it's manufactured in the USA. Notice it's got an engine on the front and an engine on the back. This is a little civilian plane, and this is what Rhodesians did with this little plane. Here you can see machine guns put above it, and rocket pods with rockets that can be fired, and the Rhodesians turned it into a combat vehicle called the Lynx. And that is a Lynx, and it's dropping a bomb, a napalm bomb, probably manufactured in Rhodesia, and the bomb is dropping. It's just above the tree there, and the bomb explodes. Napalm was invented by the Americans for use in Vietnam. It burns you to death. Very easy to make, very effective weapon. In South Africa, there's a group of people called the Suidlanders. Their spokesman is Simon Roche. And they're constantly talking about the need to evacuate whites in South Africa in order to survive against black attack, etc. I've actually been in a convoy, and the photos that you're about to see are photos that I took when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, these are photos that I took. We were going to South Africa, and we had to drive along a road that was about 500 kilometers long, and we could have been attacked. And what I'm going to show you is how a convoy was organized. There was a little police vehicle. We had a couple of these. I don't know if it was three or five of them accompanying the convoy. The convoy was very large. You were talking perhaps hundreds of civilian vehicles. And we had a couple of these little pickup trucks. In the back is a machine gun with a shield. And there's the policeman sitting in the back taking a rest. And then as the convoy, this is the convoy on the go, and there's an Alouette gunship flying up and down along the convoy to protect us. And above this tree, accompanying us, is a Lynx. The way that the Rhodesians fought the small battles inside the country in the bush was by using helicopters. And they developed a tactic known as Fire Force. And Fire Force was based on those Alouettes coming in, dropping troops, circling and shooting at the blacks on the ground, and then also calling in a Lynx or a Hunter as is needed. The Rhodesians got hold of some plans of a German armored car, a very simple German armored car, the 416, and Rhodesians built their own version for their special forces. These vehicles on the left are vehicles that were built for the Seleuth Scouts. Notice lots of machine guns on the top. This one was for the Rhodesian Special Air Services. Somewhat different design with more armor and less machine guns. In 1979, the Russians decided to invade Rhodesia. So, just to explain the war, this is Mozambique. And terrorists were coming in from all sides, except here where South Africa was. And this is the 1,000-kilometer border that had been lost due to the Portuguese being gone. So there were other terrorists. The terrorists coming from here were armed and trained by the Chinese. But the Russians would also come and check up on things and also give their input. And this group of terrorists here were Zipra. This was Zanla, that was Zipra. And Zipra came in across the border. This is a lake, Lake Kariba. And they would come in through these routes. And the Russians decided to actually create a conventional army based on Russian tactics to invade Rhodesia and crush the whites. So they came up with this plan, and they started shipping equipment to Zambia. They started shipping tanks and MiG aircraft, and they were starting to train the blacks in conventional tactics. And this was their battle plan, how their armored forces were going to get into Rhodesia and eventually collapse our government. So Rhodesia had no tanks whatsoever. Our heaviest vehicle was this thing that you see on the left. It's actually a French vehicle, a French Panhard armored car. South Africans took those and upgunned them and created a thing called an Eland 90. They were the heaviest weapon, but not really a thing that could actually fight a tank. South Africa intercepted a ship from Poland that had 10 T-55s. South Africa kept two for itself and gave eight to Rhodesia. So that was our tank force. The Rhodesians decided to build other vehicles to try and combat this armored invasion, and this is the vehicle that they built. It had a heavy machine gun, and they couldn't put a heavier gun on it, but this vehicle could move very fast through the bush, and it was really a personnel carrier. I suspect that the troops were going to get out and use RPG-7s or something to actually try and shoot at the Soviet tanks. And so what the Rhodesian army also decided to do, in and amongst all these other preparations, was they decided to try and blow up every bridge in Zambia to stop those tanks actually getting to Rhodesia. And this is the map showing major bridges that they went to blow up. And after a time, they extended this into Mozambique, and they blew up railway and road bridges in Mozambique. The whites were so successful at this bridge-blowing exercise that they completely brought the economies of Zambia and Mozambique to a grinding halt for about a year. Here are Rhodesian troops climbing on a lovely Portuguese bridge. They're preparing to blow it up, and there they blow it up. Rhodesia inadvertently created a black army, and this army became very useful. When the Portuguese collapsed in Mozambique and Angola, Frelimo took over in Mozambique, and Frelimo were very hardcore communists. And once they started ruling the blacks truly came to hate them. And the Rhodesian government at that time in 1975 needed to carry out more activities in Mozambique to try and keep these blacks at bay. So what they did was they decided they needed to get these white troops, Zulu Scouts and SAS, into Mozambique, but they need to hide the fact that it's our army. So what they did was they came up with a cover story, and they invented a fake organization which they called MNR. Later it became known as RENAMO. And they set up a radio station, and they started broadcasting news. They basically broadcast what you could call almost fake news. And they broadcast news, and everything that the Rhodesian army was doing in Mozambique was attributed to this fake organization called the MNR. And then after a time, suddenly blacks began pouring across the border into Rhodesia. They wanted to join the MNR to fight Frelimo. So the whites then found themselves with these blacks, and they chose this guy as the actual leader of this army. And the whites then began training this black army, and the white special forces and these black troops then moved into Mozambique. And these blacks would fight Frelimo, and the whites would fight Zanla, and everything that happened in Mozambique was attributed to RENAMO. Now later, when Rhodesia went down, we handed over RENAMO to South Africa, and the war continued. And you'll see more about the effects of that. This is a dredger that was sunk in a harbor in Mozambique, sunk by the Rhodesian army, but credit given to RENAMO. Rhodesia also poisoned blacks who fought against us. The idea came from a university professor. He came up with the idea that, you see, the blacks... When the black communists who were fighting us didn't have normal uniforms, but the closest thing to a uniform that they had was they liked to wear denim jeans and jackets. And so they came up with this idea of taking these denim jeans and jackets and poisoning them. And they put them in a poison that can enter your body through your skin or your hair follicles. And what they did was they had blacks who would go into the townships and they would actually recruit blacks to fight against us. And then when they get successful recruits, then they give them these poisoned uniforms and they say, put this uniform on and march off to Zambia or Mozambique. You're going to be trained over there. And then as these blacks march for the weeks with this poison uniform, they get more and more sick and some of them die. We don't know exactly how effective this whole process was, but a minimum of 800 black combatants, future black combatants were killed like this. Maybe 1,000. There are some who say that it could have been very effective, but we don't really know. What I will tell you as well is that later when the blacks took over Rhodesia and what is now Zimbabwe, that the government, the black government, continued with the process of poisoning uniforms and of poisoning clothes, and they use it against their black political opposition in Zimbabwe to this day. I never believed that the whites used anthrax against the blacks, but there could be a pretty strong case for that. Right towards the end of the war, 1979 to 1980, for no apparent reason, there was an enormous outbreak of anthrax in the tribal trust lands where only the blacks live. And 171,000 cattle got anthrax, 17,000 blacks got anthrax, at least 200 blacks died. And the best support for this actually comes from academics in North America, academics and scientists who've studied this very strange outbreak that occurred only that one time and only at the end of the war. And the most likely explanation is actually that the Rhodesian Zulu scouts may have spread anthrax among the blacks as one of the final acts of the war. So it's circumstantial, but it's possible. Again, back in these tribal trust lands, we fought other dirty wars. In these tribal trust lands, there were little stores that catered for the blacks. And the Rhodesian government would give poisoned clothes to these store owners, and they would say, put it on the top shelf and never sell it. And the idea was that if terrorists broke in and stole stuff from the store, they might steal poisoned uniforms. They also gave them radios, also to put on the top shelf, never to be sold. Some of the radios had bombs in them, and when you turned them on or off, they would explode. Other radios had tracking devices in them, and the Rhodesian Air Force would come looking for you. These are probably the most complete statistics that I've ever managed to compile using various people, some of whom have built databases. These are the casualties of the Rhodesian War. The black communist armies, the two armies together at their peak, probably totaled about 55,000. And the Rhodesian army, blacks and whites, totaled 54,000. But most of the army was white, make no mistake. And a large part of that number are reservists. They are part-time soldiers. They're only called when they're needed. So this is the size of the armies, but you can see the number of people killed. The Rhodesian army, including combat, accidents, and anything else, lost a total of about 2,500 troops. But we killed between 20 and 25,000 blacks. And probably more than half of those were killed in cross-border raids. And about 7,600 civilians were killed in the war. In the war, these casualties that you see here, the brown numbers, those are blacks who were tortured or killed by black communists. So the brown numbers are blacks killed by the black communists. And the blue numbers are blacks killed by our troops. We used to call them collaborators. These are blacks who supported and worked with and accompanied the terrorists. And the Rhodesian army would just say they were killed in the crossfire. And so that is the total number of blacks we killed. Total number of whites white civilians who died in the war was maybe 500. Let's take a look at some of the Russian and Chinese weapons captured by the whites of southern Africa. Here you can see white troops in a camp across the border, and you can see the various communist weapons. You know, the blacks did not fight us with spears and shields. They fought us with communist weaponry. They got the latest weaponry from Russia and China. These are recoilless rifles, heavy machine guns captured by Rhodesia. You can see landmines, even a Russian vehicle. Now let's take a look at South Africa. South Africa did really big operations. And in a single operation, Operation Protea in 1981, the South Africans captured between 3,000 and 4,000 tons of Soviet weaponry. Here are Soviet armored cars captured by South Africa in that one operation. These are Soviet anti-tank, anti-aircraft weapons captured by South Africa. And these pictures are not complete. This is just a small portion of what was captured. Tanks, Russian tanks captured by the whites of South Africa. You can see artillery pieces, ammunition, trucks. All of this just from one operation of the South African army. The blacks got help from across the world. Everybody helped the blacks. Even European countries gave them food. And when our troops went and fought against them, we would find tins of food from various places in Europe. The whites of Southern Africa pulled off another little coup in the literal sense. Some French came and fought in Rhodesia in 1978, and these French came up with the idea that maybe we should overthrow a government on the island of the Comoros. And the French troops asked the French government if they could do this, if they could get permission to do this, and the French government said yes, the Rhodesian government said yes, the South African government said yes, and so with Rhodesian help, the French went and they overthrew the black government on that island and installed a government that was friendly to the whites. And this was a huge breakthrough for the whites of Southern Africa because it meant that Rhodesia, South Africa, and France could do all kinds of trade legally now through a nation that we controlled. You've seen how the Portuguese went down with the Carnation Revolution in 1974. The other hideous thing that happened in 1974, if the Soviets were behind the Carnation Revolution, the Americans came to also assist the whites in ending white rule. And how it happened was the Jew Henry Kissinger came to Southern Africa. Now the whites at that time hoped that America fighting in Vietnam, fighting against communist terrorists, exactly the same as we were doing, that America would be helpful and friendly to us and would actually assist us. This turned out to be a completely false hope. Instead, Kissinger came and he spoke especially to the guy in the middle there, John Forster, the Prime Minister of South Africa, and also to our leader, Ian Smith. And he came with this idea that was doing the rounds in the West called détente. And in a nutshell, détente said that if you don't fight the communists too hard, then the communists won't fight you too hard. And so the next thing that happened was all kinds of ceasefires, all kinds of things that we, advantages that we gave to the enemy, stopped fighting, did all kinds of stupid things under this notion of détente. And this fostered. He completely began to believe in this. He used to travel to black African countries and be welcomed by the blacks. And he thought that he actually came to believe that if he handed Rhodesia over to blacks, that the rest of the blacks of Africa would accept South Africa with apartheid and they would not criticize the South Africans. So he came to believe that Rhodesia was a useful sacrificial lamb. Ian Smith himself was fooled. Forster, when Kissinger came to Southern Africa, he told Ian Smith, one man, one vote is absolutely, that's the only thing the U.S. government will accept. One man, one vote. The whites only make up 4% of the population, so that means we are wiped out politically. And Kissinger said, one man, one vote, that's the only option for you people. And He also made our leader believe that if we made some sort of peace overtures with the blacks, that somehow America would come and assist us. All this was bogus, and it actually started a process that led to the direct downfall of Rhodesia. So, among the stupid things that happened was that Kissinger put pressure on Forster. Forster started cutting off ammunition and petrol to Rhodesia, and Forster even insisted that we let go, we release top terrorist leaders that we had captured and we had them under our control. And this was the beginning of the end of the whites. So the whites of Rhodesia and South Africa, then our leaders, fooled now by Kissinger, hoping America would do something wonderful at some point if we behave nicely to the blacks. So the whites of Rhodesia and South Africa decided to have elections, and elections without communists inside Rhodesia. And the guy who won is this guy, Bishop Abel Muzorewa. The apartheid government paid lots of money in his campaign to try and help him to win, and he won. But he turned out to be absolutely useless. These Christian black leaders turned out to be absolutely useless. And the war continued. The whites were still in full control of the army, and the whites were still attacking and winning all over the show. This idiot went to the British, handed over Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, as it was then called, handed it over to the British. The British decided to have elections and allowed the communists in on the elections. The communists came and cheated, which they've actually been doing ever since, and that is how the communist Mugabe came to power. So there's the communist Mugabe, and it was in this time that I left Rhodesia. I was 17 years old. My parents and all my family and others left. Two-thirds of the whites did not want to live under this guy's rule, and we left in the period 1980 to 1985. This guy instituted communism. He had political commissars ordering the white farmers around. He put all kinds of rules in place to see to it that the whites don't really get anywhere. However, the white farmers still ended up getting very rich under communism. And we'll discuss that more. In the 1980s, now that Rhodesia was gone and Mugabe was in charge, now South Africa had a new enemy to deal with, Zimbabwe. And there were some secret wars that took place in the 1980s. Firstly, RENAMO, which Rhodesia had started, was still fighting in Mozambique, and the South Africans were still arming them and supplying them from the air. Mugabe had to send troops to fight in Mozambique for 11 years to try and stop these other blacks from winning. Those blacks came close to winning. The blacks that we had... the black army that we'd created came very close to winning. Then what also happened was there was Zanla and Zipra. They represented two tribes. The two communist sides represented two tribes in Zimbabwe. And this tribe in the south, whose military was known as ZAPU, they began to think about the possibility of seceding from Zimbabwe. And they began creating their own guerrillas to start doing various things in the country and start murdering and doing things that would help them with their secession. Meanwhile, the South African government, with some ex-Rhodesians, were busy also training up some blacks. And these blacks came to be known as Super ZAPU. So you had ZAPU coming from inside, and you also had ZAPU coming from South Africa secretly. And these different groups were busy carrying out small-scale guerrilla warfare here inside Zimbabwe against Mugabe. But now, this is an example of how, and this is very important, never assume that black people will solve a problem the way white people solve the problem. Never make that assumption. Because here was Robert Mugabe facing a small-scale guerrilla onslaught, and if he'd behaved like whites, he would have said, okay, let's find who the guerrillas are and let's catch them and kill them. That's not what Mugabe decided to do. Mugabe said, well, if there's dissident activity in the country, I don't know who the dissidents are. So if there's dissident activity in a village, why not let's just kill everybody in the village? And that's what he decided. That's what he did. So he had North Korean trained troops, the 5th Brigade, and he sent them. And whenever there was some kind of guerrilla warfare, they would just go and they'd just kill everybody. And they'd just chuck their bodies down mine shafts and everything. And in a period of about 4 years, he killed between 20 and 30,000 blacks. So that was his solution to guerrilla warfare. Africa had a world war, but I bet you the liberals never told you about it. In the period in the 1990s to 2006, there was a literal world war inside that country known as the Congo. That's an extremely rich territory. It's got uranium and all kinds of very valuable minerals. And America used to control the dictator that ran that country. However, as a result of the Rwandan genocide, some blacks fled into the Congo. And this set off black-on-black fighting, just like that black-on-black fighting from the 1800s that I was telling you about. Anyway, this thing eventually ended up involving more than a dozen black countries started taking part in this war. Eventually, there was about 140,000 black troops fighting in this conflict. And between 2.7 and more than 5 million blacks were killed. This is probably the greatest slaughter of blacks in modern history, but you won't hear a word about it. And Zimbabwe, which was communist, and Angola, which was communist, sent important armies into the war in Angola. And they helped to install a communist called Kabila. And the Congo is communist to this day. So Mugabe began to seize the farms of the whites in Zimbabwe in the year 2000. This chart will give you an idea of the GDP growth in southern Africa, in Zimbabwe. You can see when he took power, the economy was growing by 14%, and then as the decades went by, started getting worse. And what happened was, because he was also fighting that war in the Congo, and lots of black soldiers were getting killed in the Congo, eventually he broke his own economy. And a strange event took place in 1995. The 5,000 white farmers and other businessmen who were in Zimbabwe teamed up with the blacks, and they formed a political party called the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change. And the whites basically were providing the money, and the blacks were providing the votes. And so the MDC came into being, and the idea was to try and vote the communists out of power. And the MDC actually began to win at elections, but the communists just ignore that. The guys with the guns, they do the counting, and they say, no, you lost. Anyway, so what happened was, when Mugabe realized that these whites were funding his political opposition, and they were starting to beat him in politics, he went and he seized all the farms of the whites in the next 10 years. And the MDC, because the MDC was a peaceful voting political party, they could never face off against the communists. They just get killed. So when they seized the farms in Zimbabwe, these are the kinds of scenes that took place. And the government of Zimbabwe created a big lie that the entire liberal mass media across the world has continued to put out. And they said that the blacks of their own accord were invading the farms. The truth of the matter is that the Central Intelligence Organization and the army were working with the black government, and they were finding which farmers were the biggest threat to the politicians. And they then targeted those farmers one by one. They knocked out those farmers one by one. Army vehicles even brought those blacks in to invade those farms. And there were black officers in civilian clothes with AK-47s around. So the mass media of the world portrayed it as being the blacks wanting the farmland. Total nonsense. It was the government that wanted to destroy the whites. And so this is some of the violence that was used against the white farmers in Zimbabwe. And you can see they've been beaten by blacks, sometimes with sticks. There's a farmer and his wife, and they've been beaten. Sometimes they burn down some of the buildings on their farms and their vehicles. And any blacks who are friendly to the whites get themselves, they are themselves beaten and tortured. And there's a black guy wearing a t-shirt saying Mugabe killed our white farmers. So when the farms were seized, the whole Zimbabwe economy began to collapse. And that chart shows the Zimbabwe dollar versus the US dollar from 2001 to 2009. You can see hyperinflation just hit into there. And this chart shows you how people drew their money and savings out of the banks. And during this time, they continued withdrawing money from the banks even up to 2016. So you had hyperinflation, and the government ended up printing notes like this and bearer checks, $100 million, $100 trillion. And that currency used to be equal to and even stronger than the South African rand. It turned out to be totally worthless. And Zimbabwe is a country that doesn't have a currency to this day. They actually trade in US dollars and South African rands to this day. And here was a guy who went to have a bit of a meal, let's say at a fast food outlet, and the meal cost him $1.2 billion. And that's a bit of humor, a sign in the toilet, no cardboard, no cloth, no Zim dollars. And here are blacks laughing at the whole situation, calling themselves starving billionaires. Everything that liberals tell you is a lie. And when you study the events in Southern Africa, you will find that every single prediction that liberals have ever made about how races interact is totally false. And you will be able to see how it actually plays out in the real world. So the MDC had its main support base in the cities. And Mugabe decided to punish them. And the way he punished them, I think the blacks built some buildings, not quite to plan. And so Mugabe instituted this thing called Operation Murambatsvina in 2005. And he basically sent in bulldozers to bash down houses and buildings. He made 1 million black people homeless. But I'll bet you no liberal ever complained about that. And here you can see smashing up houses, smashing up buildings. And here's a short video made by the blacks themselves of this Operation Murambatsvina. That was, under communism, if you don't vote correctly, the government will punish you. In Rhodesia, I just want to show you a few statistics of the white population of Rhodesia. During the time of our rebellion against the British, by 1975, 10 years after the rebellion, our GDP was still growing by 10% per annum in the middle of a war. We were actually doing very well for ourselves. And that chart on the left, that shows you the brown are the blacks and the white and the blue are the whites. The whites were between 4 and 5% of the population. But we ran the country and we fought the war and we were in control during all that time. Here is a better graph of the number of whites. You can see that in 1965, at the time of the rebellion, you see population had fallen a bit. Possibly whites who were afraid of the talk of rebellion and had probably left. But after the rebellion, the white population actually starts growing and more whites are coming in and life is, and despite the war and everything, the whites are carrying on. And it's only when the communists come to power and the whites just pack their bags that the population starts dwindling. And this thing is the black population in the meantime. So let's take a bit of a look at the other wars of Southern Africa, the ones below, the ones in flatter terrain. Here we see German Southwest Africa, which was under South African control. They looked at the Sulu Scouts, and they liked this idea of blacks catching blacks. And they decided to try and invent their own version of it, and they came up with a police unit called Kufut. That's that name there. And Kufut ended up being centered around that vehicle called a Casper. That was a fantastic vehicle built in South Africa, a mine-protected vehicle, mine-protected combat vehicle, has two machine guns on the top. And Kufut came to be, you'd have about 10 blacks, and the commander would be a white guy, and the commander would be the guy, the white guy manning the machine gun. He'd command the vehicle. Sometimes there'd be a second white involved, but the rest of the troops in that vehicle were black. Kufut were probably more than 80% of the unit was black, and they were paid bonuses for killing black communists. And you can see that this is probably what we could call the beginnings of armored warfare in Africa. This is how it works in Africa. So because they got bonuses for killing communist terrorists, The blacks didn't like having all the corpses being put inside the actual vehicle, so they took to tying all those that they had killed, they tie them to the bumpers and they tie them to all parts of the vehicles, so the vehicles would drive around with these dead enemy troops. And of course it has a bit of a psychological effect because everybody can see the dead hanging off these vehicles. But Kufut was very successful in what is now Namibia. The liberals have told you that all the non-whites hate apartheid, that nobody would ever want anything to do with a white racial state, that black people would never support anything to do with a white racial state. Well, some of you may know that the French have got the French Foreign Legion. Well, apartheid had its own Foreign Legion. It was known as 32 Battalion. And there is 32 Battalion. Most of those black troops are black troops from Angola. There were Portuguese in there. There were also a couple of Rhodesians, a couple of Americans. But there was the Foreign Legion of the apartheid government. And that unit, 32 Battalion, carried out some of the most intense and long-term fighting of any unit in the South African Army. And as you can see, mostly blacks. Just a little bit of a look at some of the consequences, some of the long-term consequences of the actions of the whites of Southern Africa in our wars. In Angola, when the black communists came to power, that kicked off a civil war among the black communists themselves. And later on, South Africa got involved, even the CIA got involved, and one of those black armies then became our allies. And in that war that lasted 26 years, more than 500,000 people got killed. Another example is, I've told you of RENAMO, created by Rhodesia, later supported by South Africa. Frelimo in Mozambique had no opposition at all. The only opposition that existed was RENAMO, created by Rhodesia, supported by South Africa. That RENAMO went on to fight a 15-year war against the blacks in Mozambique, and almost 1 million blacks died in that war, mostly from famine. So that is an indirect consequence of the actions of the whites in their fight. As I've mentioned to you, ZAPU and Super ZAPU, the fight inside Zimbabwe in the 1980s, South Africa sending in some guerrillas. This is known as the Gukurahundi. And Mugabe ended up killing 20 to 30,000 blacks because he wasn't interested in hunting down individual terrorists. My own prediction is that the consequences of these wars is not yet over, that Zimbabwe itself faces a future civil war. I can't tell you how many thousands of blacks the communist government has murdered over the years, but I know that millions of blacks have fled from Zimbabwe and continue to flee from Zimbabwe to this day. Millions have fled. Many millions are in South Africa and they've moved to other places. There is a hatred that has been built up in Zimbabwe between the communist blacks and the MDC blacks. And my prediction is that sometime in the future, I can't tell you when, there is going to be an extremely bloody conflict among the blacks in Zimbabwe. So you haven't seen the last consequences of the actions of the whites. Let's talk a bit about South Africa. Apartheid. Apartheid, the great evil of apartheid that the entire world never could, was being told about all the time. Apartheid came into being in 1948 and lasted until 1994. And the main combatant there is the African National Congress, the ANC, they are the government of today. And I want to show you some of the military things that they tried to do. Like I've mentioned, South Africa's terrain is different, it's flatter. And there are many reasons why the war in South Africa and Namibia is different to the other wars. But a point I want to make about apartheid. When the Boers were defeated by the British in the Anglo-Boer War in 1900, the Boers were themselves oppressed in their own country. The English speakers kept them out of business. They were disempowered. They were not allowed to own businesses, not allowed to engage in trading. So these Boers decided to seize control of South Africa through a secret method, and they set up a secret society called the Broederbond. That is Afrikaans for brotherhood. And this secret society infiltrated everything. It infiltrated the government, the police, business, and it even created banks and insurance companies that exist to this day in South Africa. And their great political creation was a political party called the National Party. And that National Party basically fought against the white liberals. And when the National Party came to power in 1948, they created a racial state. They are the people, this Afrikaans secret society decided to take all whites and unite them as a single group. So these Afrikaans people embraced English speakers as well. And this is what came to be known as apartheid, the whites versus the blacks. But it was these Afrikaans people who decided to gather all whites together and to protect them and see to it that they rule the country. So once apartheid came into being, the communists, the liberals, the Jews immediately started attacking them. In fact, they called the National Party, they even called them Malan's Nazis, because one of their leaders was Malan, he was a Christian, and they referred to Malan's Nazis. And so the moment that apartheid came into being, all these liberals, communists, and Jews started stirring up the blacks to start fighting the whites. Anyway, South Africa's terrain is much flatter than the other countries. And the war in South Africa, the ANC and other communists did try landmines. They did try farm attacks. They tried all those things. But the whites of South Africa were so strong that this thing didn't fly, that the terrorists had minuscule effects. The whites were so dominant in South Africa. And so eventually, the war in South Africa became completely different to any of the other wars. These black communists were so desperate, eventually the only thing they could do was to plant bombs in the cities, and they would bomb civilian targets. They didn't even fight the army much. And in South Africa, the population of whites in South Africa is more developed. The population of the whites is much bigger than all the other countries. And the whites had a firm military grip on the country. So you could say that South Africa and Namibia, in my opinion, South Africa and Namibia are the two countries in Southern Africa that are suited to what you could call mechanized warfare. Guerrilla warfare does not work there. And the South African military of the time was actually seeing Soviets and tanks and jets as its biggest threat. And it was preparing for that kind of war. It was preparing for a full conventional war against the Russians and the Chinese. When I was in South Africa in the 1980s, it was my opinion that the white liberals and the newspapers were the ones that brought the morale of the whites down, made the whites stop believing in themselves, and helped to just make the whites give up. This is the Church Street bombing, the biggest bombing that took place in South Africa. This was a car bomb, 1983. I lived about two blocks away from where this bomb went off, and two of the whites who were killed were whites that I'd worked with. And here you can see some of it. And they planted this bomb along a busy road and set it off to go off at the busiest time of day. They wanted to kill civilians. These are terrorists in the truest form. And somebody drew up a list of all the bombs of Nelson Mandela and the ANC. But these are just the major ones. This does not include all the small limpet mines, Russian limpet mines that they were using all across South Africa for a long time. Now, as you've seen in other parts of Africa, that when the blacks have got blacks, when there are blacks who are friendly to whites, the black communists kill them in the most gruesome manner that they possibly can. And South Africa was no different. Nelson Mandela himself, originally, in his original writings, were that he intended to cut the noses off of traitors. But later they decided, they came up with an idea they liked even more. They came up with an idea called necklacing. And his wife, Winnie Mandela, in 1985 said, "With our boxes of matches and our necklaces, we shall liberate this country." And necklacing was only for black people. This is necklacing. You see that black guy on the left? They put a tire around his neck. They fill it with petrol. They're going to set him on fire. And here is another black. He's being burned to death. That's what happens to blacks who are friendly to the whites. There you can see the end results of necklacing. These are statistics from the South African police in those days. And these statistics are different to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which has halved all of these numbers. But according to the South African police in those days, more than 400 blacks were killed using necklacing, and almost 400 blacks were burned to death. And then there were a whole bunch of injuries. And those people rule South Africa right now. In this little video, you're going to hear the voice of Ronald Reagan, the President of America. He's going to describe necklacing to you, and you're going to see a bit of necklacing taking place. And if you listen to Ronald Reagan, you'll see that everything that I've told you, he knew. The CIA knew everything that was going on in Southern Africa. They knew all these things. They knew who was fighting. They knew why they were fighting. They knew why they were doing these things. The Americans and others knew the truth about what was happening to us in Southern Africa. And this is probably the only time any politician ever spoke about it. So here's Ronald Reagan. And you're going to watch them killing a black, like a black policeman, or any other black who's friendly to the whites. Oh, sorry. I'll get back there.
A tire is filled with kerosene and gasoline, placed around the neck of an alleged collaborator, and ignited. The victim may be a black policeman, a teacher, a soldier, a civil servant. It makes no difference. The atrocity is designed to terrorize blacks into ending all racial cooperation.
Terrorize blacks into ending all racial cooperation. Ronald Reagan knew it. The CIA knows it. I tried to compile some statistics of some of the casualties from the different wars, but it's very interesting. You struggle to find numbers. I suspect even that some of these communists are actually embarrassed by their losses. I can't find totals for the total number of FAPLA, that was the blacks in Angola. What we do know is that SWAPO in Southwest Africa, according to the whites' statistics, we killed 11,000 of them. Kufut probably killed most of them. In our wars in Southern Africa, South Africa killed between 2,000 and 2,500 Cubans, because the Cubans came and fought in Africa. We killed at least 54 Russians in Angola, and at least 11,000 Russian officers and troops came into Angola alone. Though the Russians were all over southern Africa, they were all over Zambia, even Mozambique. And the Soviets sent shiploads of heavy weaponry to southern Africa to arm the blacks to fight the whites. And the ANC itself, the people who rule South Africa, you cannot find statistics for how many of them got killed in battle. But a South African author by the name of Paul Kruger has done his own study, and he says that he thinks the South Africans killed about 3,200 ANC. South Africa, in all the wars that South Africa fought, and we will be discussing the big battles of Angola, in all the wars that the whites of South Africa fought, they lost between 2,000 and 2,500 troops in all their fighting, and you'll see the extent of the fighting that they got up to. Here are terrorist victims. The current government of South Africa, the ANC, engaged in terrorism in the 1980s. Assassinated people, planted bombs. Here are the number of people they killed, and they weren't actually that effective. Those red columns show how many people they killed in a year. These are statistics from the police of the time, and they killed maybe 100 people a year. Sometimes they injured quite a lot of people, but as a fighting force, they weren't that effective. Now, apartheid. You've heard about the cruelty of apartheid, and you know there have even been ministers in the South African government who in parliament have actually said, oh, apartheid killed millions of people. Total lie. Complete lie. Even the liberals, even the academics in the Western world do not accept that number. In fact, the number that is accepted by the liberals and academics outside South Africa is 21,000. And that number comes from a book called A Crime Against Humanity, and it itself was written by liberals. So this is liberals counting the death toll themselves, and you have to wonder how good their counting is, and you'll see some strange things in their counting. So they say that under apartheid, 21,000 people got killed under this cruel system. However, the truth of the matter is that this is over a period of 46 years. And the first assumption is that all these people who are killed are blacks killed by the oppressive white regime. That's the assumption. But when you look more closely, you'll see this is not true. The first weird aspect of this total is that in the period of 41 years, they, according to them, 7,000 people died. So it wasn't such a brutal system over 41 years. Again, you assume that all of those people are blacks. And then suddenly you'll find a weird thing happening. You'll see that in the last 4 years, suddenly double that number is just suddenly killed. Suddenly it gets much more brutal than that. What we do know from the statistics of the government of the time and even by the liberals' own analysis is that the white army killed only 518 people during this time of the 14,000. And even the liberals and academics agree that black communists, they call them radicals to hide the communist angle, that black communists killed about 8,500 of that total. And then there's a mysterious 4,900 who got killed, and we don't know who killed them. We don't know, you know, that's kind of left hanging in the air. But I will show you something. That chart that you see on the left there, that is a chart from a book published by the South African government called Talking with the ANC. Paul Fromm actually has a copy. I saw a copy in his among his books. And in there is a chart of the actual fighting in the period 1985 to 1986. Those brown columns are the number of black communists killed by the white army in those months. The red columns are blacks killed by black communists. And so if you look at that, you'll see that blacks are busy killing a lot of other blacks. And possibly you could say half of the people who died are blacks killed by black communists. and the others are black communists killed by the whites. So that falls into this period, and you can see that clearly not all of that 7,000 could just be blacks killed by the whites. No, there's some other number in there. The communists created lots of unrest. And now to understand what happened in those last 4 years. Why did so many people get killed in those last 4 years? In 1978 to 1979, the ANC went off to Vietnam. They went to go and speak to the communists in Vietnam to see how did those communists defeat the Americans. After speaking to the Vietnamese, they came back with a new tactic, and their new strategy was called a people's war. The whole purpose of this was to stir up the entire black population and to try to get the entire black population to go and fight the white population. And that was what the ANC was trying to do. They were trying to create a massive race war in South Africa. And they were talking about setting the country on fire. You know, a spark that would set the blacks ablaze and the blacks would go crazy and they'd just kill the whites. And if you look at these statistics, you'll see that up to this period, 1990, you'll see that the number of people killed by these, during this unrest, you'll see that about 1,000 people died in a year at its maximum, because unrest and strikes and murders was the method used by the ANC. And then suddenly you'll see it comes down a little bit, then suddenly you'll see it just explodes upwards, and then it starts coming down again. And this is that period, 1990 to 1994, where 14,000 died. So suddenly you see that suddenly they kill a whole lot in a single year, almost 2,500. And what actually happened in that year is that the white government unbanned the ANC. So once the ANC was unbanned and allowed to operate openly inside South Africa, the first thing they did was they tried to start a race war. And that is what they were doing there. But the government, even then, even in its weak stance then, the government still managed to bring down the killing. It's very possible that the government still, the army still, managed to control and stop this race war from burning out of control. Just to give you an idea of how unsuccessful these black communist terrorists were against the whites, these are the security force casualties. And you can see that in any year, the total number of blacks and whites from the military who were actually killed was no more than 50 in a year. They sometimes injured quite a bunch, but they were killing only like about 50 in a year. And if you look at other statistics and trial records from the time of apartheid, you'll see that the total number of people killed and all this violence that these people are stoking, that the total number of people is probably 9,000. So the untold story of apartheid is that of those 21,000, how many were really killed by the whites? And it's not 21,000. That number's got to be a lot lower. It's got to be a lot lower. But the whites get beaten over the head over that endlessly. Let's just take a look at some of the technology of the whites of South Africa. South Africa was like a miniature superpower in Southern Africa. And South Africa had such determination and power that it was probably the only nation in the Western world that dared to take on the Russians directly. When Britain, America, Europeans, Canada, nobody was going to take on the Russians directly, the 4 million whites of South Africa were going to do it. So this ship that you see is the biggest supply ship in the South African Navy, and it was built in the time of apartheid. It was designed and built completely in South Africa. When the South Africans fought the Russians and the Cubans in Angola, They met up with a weapon that the Russians had developed in World War II. You may have heard of the Stalin organ, which is a vehicle that fires large batteries of rockets. The Russians used them against the Germans extensively in World War II. Well, the South African army found themselves on the receiving end of these Stalin organs. But the South Africans went and created their own rocket system called the Valkyrie rocket system, and they fired back at the Russians. The next thing that they created, also to counter these Stalin organs, now South Africa had been under an arms embargo since 1963. South Africa was not allowed to buy military weapons from any country in the Western world. So South Africa began to develop its own stuff. And when they met up with these Stalin organs in Angola, there's an interesting Canadian link to this. They built this beautiful artillery piece called the G5. And the G5 was actually designed by a Canadian, a guy called Bull. And Bull was later apparently murdered, I think, in Europe, possibly by the Mossad. In
Brussels.
Yeah, okay. So this guy, this Canadian, designed this fantastic artillery piece that the South African army used in Angola in heavy fighting. This artillery piece could fire a shell 30 kilometers, and it could fire a rocket-assisted shell 50 kilometers. Just as an aside, this Canadian, Bull, his goal in life was he wanted to launch satellites from cannons. That's what he really wanted to achieve. And he was absolutely brilliant until, of course, somebody decided to get rid of him. South Africa took the fantastic G5, put it on its own vehicle, and created one of the finest self-propelled artillery pieces in the world. It's known as the G6. And this weapon was used in Angola. South Africa also developed pilotless aircraft. And this is a pilotless aircraft from the 1980s used in Angola. My own investigation is that South Africa probably had many more pilotless aircraft, and possibly some are even classified. South Africa had been working on pilotless aircraft right back to the early 1970s. This is the only one that they publicly acknowledge the existence of, but they could have lots of other stuff. The whites of South Africa invented something. They created a world first. In the 1980s, they came up with the helmet-mounted display for fighter pilots. It was so that the pilot could look and shoot, and that was the concept. And they had some kind of display, sort of like that thing. So it's known as a helmet-mounted display, and even Wikipedia acknowledges this fact. They say HMDs were introduced in helicopters during this time, were fielded by the South African Air Force after the South African system had been proven in combat, playing a role in downing Soviet aircraft over Angola. The Soviets embarked on a crash program to counter the technology. By 1985, the Soviets had their MiG-29s with HMDs. And if you listened carefully, this year, 2019, the U.S. Air Force is boasting about having HMDs in its aircraft. It's finally caught up with South Africa 35 years later. South Africa, again, you'll see the French influence. South Africa had French Mirage jets. And when it was up against MiG-23s in Angola, the South Africans found themselves totally outclassed. But not to be stopped, the South Africans went and they modified that plane. They modified more than 50% of that plane until they ended up with literally a brand new plane, and they called it the Cheetah. And that modified Mirage, the Cheetah, went on to shoot down MiGs over Angola. The only attack helicopter ever designed and built in Southern Africa was built by the South Africans. This was an experimental attack helicopter that came into being in 1985, and underneath the nose is a 20mm cannon. And that led to this amazing vehicle called the Rooi Valk attack helicopter. Rooi Valk is Afrikaans for Red Hawk. And this thing is literally, it's almost a match for the American Apache. It's a lot cheaper. And the moment this thing came into being, the Americans immediately saw to it that this thing is not exported. But built, designed and built in South Africa. Under apartheid, the whites of South Africa entered space. And what you're looking at there is an RSA-3 rocket. It was a solid fuel rocket. Space begins officially at 100 kilometers. This rocket was fired to at least 200 kilometers, maybe even 300 kilometers. This thing technically entered space. And this rocket, this basically intercontinental ballistic missile, could drop a 330 kilogram explosive warhead on Washington, D.C. And it could drop a 400 kilogram explosive warhead on Moscow itself. The whites of South Africa. That is Overberg. That is the control play. That is our control center in South Africa from which we used to launch rockets. There's an RSA-3 rocket going in, going up. South Africa is the only country in Southern Africa that fought tank battles, true tank battles, in the African bush. The tank that you see on the left there, that is known as an olifant, that is Afrikaans for elephant, and it's basically a modified British Centurion tank. This is the heavy battle tank of the South African Army. Some of these tanks broke down a bit, and with tracks breaking, etc., and some of these tanks were captured by the Russians, and here are the Russians showing off a captured olifant. A unexpected discovery by the South Africans was when they were encountering tanks in the Angolan bush, they began to develop something and modify something that was not actually intended to fight tanks. They had this vehicle that you see on the left. It's known as a Rattle. It's a Rattle 20, and the gun on it is a 20mm gun. That vehicle is designed to just carry troops into combat. That's all it's for. And this Rattle 20 is not meant to actually fight tanks. But as the war progressed, the South Africans began to put bigger turrets and guns on this thing, and they created the Rattle 90. And this thing became a tank killer. The biggest battle that occurred in Southern Africa, the biggest true high-tech battle, fought with the latest weaponry, occurred in the 1980s in Angola. There were weapons that the South Africans captured in Angola that had never before been seen by the Western world. Not by America, not by Europe. Nobody had even seen these things before. And the South Africans captured some of that stuff. So, the biggest battle that occurred was the Battle of Kiwito Kuanavale. And in the sort of liberal interpretation of history, it's very much like the Germans, where they try to take the credit away from actual victories that the Germans had, and they kind of hide some of the stuff, and they don't want you to know about certain things. Well, the Battle of Kiwito Kuanavale is much like that. They try to pretend that it wasn't really a victory, but in actual fact, it was a total victory for the whites, actually. In the tank battles, there were many tank battles in the bush in Angola, and the South African tanks were fighting against Soviet tanks, sometimes or often at ranges of 50 to 150 meters. Dense bush, and these vehicles were literally meeting each other almost head on. In Operation Hooper, the South Africans lost one olifant and one Rattle, but in return, they destroyed 21 Russian T-55s. Now, those Rattles became a big tank fighter, even though they were completely unsuited to the task. The average Russian tank could shoot twice as far as a Rattle. It could shoot twice as fast as a Rattle. It could reload really quickly. And it only needed one good hit on a Rattle to destroy a Rattle. Those Rattles had to hit a Russian tank on average 5 times in order to hopefully hit it in a weak spot, and only then could it destroy the Russian tank. So with that disadvantage still, those Rattles outperformed the Soviet tanks. In the Battle of Cueto Cuanavale, FAPLA, who were the communists of Angola, fielded 150 T-55 and T-62 tanks. The South African army wiped out 98 of them, totally shattering their armor, completely ripping it to pieces. Our ally, UNITA, which was black, they had 24 tanks. I don't know the statistics there. South Africa in that battle fielded 13 Olifants, losing 3. But there is the amazing Rattle. 120 Rattles fought, and only 4 got knocked out. We lost about 7 other light armored cars. But it should be quite clear, the South African army ripped their forces to pieces. In the air, South Africa shot down 12 MiG aircraft for the loss of 1 Mirage. And this is the great lesson of South Africa in tank warfare in the bush, in the African bush. They produced this armored car called the Rooikat. It means the red cat. But this is a tank-killing armored car. And it's got an interesting design. It's actually got a German design. 8 wheels. A proven German design from World War II. 8 wheels are better than 6. This vehicle could move down a road at 120 kilometers an hour. And in the dense bush, it could race through the bush at 50 kilometers an hour. And it has a good, accurate aiming system. It locks onto a target. Just another note about the Rattles versus the Russian tanks. The Rattles were sometimes so fast that they went behind the Russian tanks and they shot them from behind. But if this weapon only came into being in 1987 and the war was winding down and this vehicle never saw combat, though it exists to this day, if this vehicle had to fight the Russian tanks, it would have torn them to pieces. The whites of Southern Africa, having their oil threatened or cut off, the whites had to do things to try and survive despite not having oil supplies. South Africa got German oil from coal technology. The Germans invented oil from coal at the end of World War I. This is a plant that the Germans used in World War II. They used oil from coal a lot. In South Africa, there's a company called Sasol. It does nothing but oil from coal. And it was brought into being in order to ensure that South Africa could survive, even if the rest of the world cut off the oil to South Africa. And their plan was to store the oil, and I think they did store oil underground in old mines. They pumped it into these old mines. Rhodesia also tried to get oil out of coal. But our technology, we were much more backward compared to the South Africans. So our oil from coal was a total failure. But what we did do was we grew a lot of sugar cane, we created ethanol, and we blended ethanol with petrol. And that allowed us to have a lower dependency on oil. And just to give you an idea of the scale of South African oil from coal, in a single day at Secunda, they were taking 120,000 tons of coal, and they produce 160,000 barrels of oil in a single day. South Africa had nuclear technology. That plant over there is Coburg, was built by the French. And everything about South Africa's nuclear technology actually centers around the French, though the French are never really mentioned. And when it came into being in 1984, that chart shows you the electrical output from our nuclear power plant, and it's actually been increasing all the way up to 2017. In the late 1960s, the South African government decided to look at using nuclear explosions for peaceful purposes. South African engineers studied these possibilities, and they concluded that we could use nuclear explosions for mining, for building underground oil storage, and for dredging harbors. This would be called nuclear excavation. Officially, the only country that's ever tried nuclear excavation is the Soviet Union, and it was a big flop. But South Africa may well have become the first in the world to actually pull it off. South Africa began to look at nuclear bombs for military purposes when the Soviets and the Cubans started coming into Angola. So that's when they decided they've got to start building nuclear bombs in case the Soviets use tactical or other nuclear weapons against the South African army. So the South Africans decided that when they test their nuclear stuff, they're going to test it on land. And they drilled a test hole at a place called Fastrap in the Northern Cape, and they completed the hole in 1977. The American satellites picked up the presence of this thing. The Americans in 1977 knew that South Africa was preparing to do nuclear tests in the future. The Americans said nothing about it. Then in 1979, the Americans went and the Americans claimed that they detected a nuclear explosion in the sea to the south of South Africa. And they said that South Africa and Israel had exploded a nuclear bomb in the sea. But in actual fact, the area where they detected this is actually a place where the French explode nuclear weapons. But the moment that the Americans claimed they had detected this nuclear explosion, they immediately cut off all nuclear fuel to South Africa. France and America were the only two countries that supplied nuclear fuel to South Africa. And immediately after this so-called nuclear explosion, the Americans and then the French cut off nuclear fuel to South Africa. However, within a few years, the South Africans figured out how to get their own enriched uranium, how to get their own nuclear fuel, and they didn't need it from America or anybody anymore. The nuclear program was the South Africans built a total of 5 nuclear bombs and 1 test bomb. They actually built it underground in the capital of South Africa. And the nuclear program was shut down by our politicians who decided to surrender the country. This vehicle that you see here is called a Beerstrook. It's Afrikaans meaning cattle truck, and it's a bit of a fun name. But this vehicle, the wheels were 2 meters high, and that vehicle was intended to allow South Africa's rockets, which were basically intercontinental ballistic missiles, to be fired from varying positions so that they couldn't be hit by incoming missiles from other countries. In the 1980s, South Africa was busy designing satellites. So under apartheid, we went into space and we designed satellites. And now we can hardly keep the lights on. Anyway, the population of the whites of Southern Africa in 1975. The whites of Namibia, smallest population, then Rhodesia, then Mozambique, then Angola, and that's the whites of South Africa. The whites of South Africa are the largest group of whites in Southern Africa by far. More than 3/4 of the whites who lived in Southern Africa live in South Africa itself. Heard lots of bad things about apartheid, and you've heard about the most evil man who ruled South Africa, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, the architect of apartheid. Verwoerd wasn't even South African. He was actually Dutch. He was born in Holland. And I think he even studied in Canada at a point. I know that he studied in Germany as well. At the age of 26, he was a professor of applied psychology. He later headed the sociology department of a university. But he pulled off some of the greatest political feats of the whites of Southern Africa. When the British were busy dumping their entire empire, this guy quickly went and had South Africa turned into a republic so that Britain could no longer tell us to hand over the country. By doing that, he probably bought the whites more than 30 years of self-rule. Very clever move. Apartheid is oppressive and evil, but apartheid has only been on trial once, actually. Liberia and Ethiopia took apartheid to court at the International Court in The Hague. And Verwoerd organized a team of lawyers, and they fought the court battle at the International Court in The Hague. And apartheid won. Apartheid is not oppressive. The judges at the International Court in The Hague said apartheid is not an oppressive system. However, if you go on the internet, you'll see that on Wikipedia, the United Nations has declared apartheid a crime against humanity. All that nonsense. If you actually study apartheid, you'll see that under apartheid, blacks were actually given their own territories. These were known as Bantustans or homelands. Some of those homelands, like the first one that became independent in 1962, they had their own constitution, their own parliament, their own police, their own army. They could rule themselves, hold their own elections, and the South African government had no jurisdiction over them. And I think they even gave them additional money from Pretoria as well. And if you allow people to rule themselves and vote for their own politicians and to do whatever they want in their own territory, how is that oppressive? But apparently apartheid is oppressive. The sort of untold story of apartheid is that the blacks did not want to go and live in their own homelands. The blacks moved to the urban areas where the whites were. And then everybody focused on that and said, oh, that's oppressive. But if the blacks truly wanted to develop their own place, they had their own places. In fact, they had homelands, which they, I think still apply. There are pieces of territory where blacks can go and they can build a house anywhere. They don't have to buy land in order to build a house. They can build a house anywhere and they can farm anywhere in their tribal territory, anywhere. And it used to be like that under apartheid. I think it still exists to this day, but you will never hear anybody talk about it at all.
So what does it say, assassinated there?
Verwoerd was assassinated. He's the only leader in the history of South Africa that was assassinated. Whites in Africa did not assassinate each other. This man is the only exception. And that in and of itself is a very interesting story. He died more or less at the same time as John F. Kennedy. We could say he died in the age of assassination, and there were two assassination attempts on his life by communists, but there's a lot of weird stuff about it, which I'm not going to go into. But who really killed him? That is a very, very interesting and untold story, which I will be telling.
What year was he killed?
66.
Yeah.
66.
You could say that is the JFK of South Africa. When we whites were fighting these blacks, we said we were fighting communism. We said that we were fighting blacks who want one-party states. These blacks have no interest in democracy. There's no such thing as democracy in Southern Africa. And you just have to look at these countries and you'll see that what I'm telling you is true. Angola is ruled by the MPLA. They are communists. They came to power in 1974. They are in power to this day, 45 years. And just remember, apartheid existed only for 46 years. These blacks have ruled Angola for 45 years nonstop. They've never lost power. Frelimo came into power in Mozambique in 74. They still rule Mozambique to this day. Zimbabwe is still ruled to this day by ZANU, the same blacks that we fought. Namibia is ruled by SWAPO since 1989. South Africa itself is ruled by the ANC since 1994, 25 years. Every one of these countries is described by the international media and the press. They describe it as a democracy. Yet not one of these political parties has lost even one election ever in all those years. So when we said we were fighting communism and we were fighting a one-party state, I think that the history bears that out. And I'm going to tell you something that is in my book. Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, when he lost power in the 1980s, he at one point was talking to one of the government ministers ruling Zimbabwe. And while he was just having a chat with this black guy, Smith says to him, how was it that you blacks came to become communists? So the black member of parliament said to Ian Smith, he said, the Russians took us to Cuba and they showed us communism there and we weren't impressed. The Russians took us to Russia and they showed us communism there and we weren't impressed. And then one day the Russians said to us, with this system, you can stay in power forever. And that is when we converted to communism. And I call it power forever. And you can see it in Southern Africa. that the whites were not lying about anything. I knew P.W. Botha personally. He told me a number of things, but the most important with regard to what I've told you is that at the time when the Soviets were sending shiploads of MiGs, tanks, ammunition, artillery, rockets to Angola, they spent billions of US dollars arming the blacks in southern Africa, but especially in Angola, building up an army that even included Eastern Europeans. That when the Soviets were sending these shiploads of weapons, the whites of South Africa, the white government, sent a request to the United States Congress, and they said to them, please, please, will you mine the harbors of Angola so that these ships can't, so that these ships with all these weapons cannot get into Africa? And the American Congress just turned the request down. And white men in Africa, white men have been winning wars in Africa, but the only time that white men are allowed to fight wars in Africa and nobody complains is when they fight them for blacks. In the 1960s, there was a British mercenary called Colonel Mike Hoare. This is a photograph from that time. He got whites from Rhodesia and South Africa to come and join him as mercenaries, and a few hundred white men defeated a black army in the middle of Africa. But nobody complained about that because his paymaster was black. The greatest modern mercenary in southern Africa is that white man in the middle. His name is Eben Barlow. In fact, I know Eben Barlow. When I ran my website, African Crisis, Eben Barlow came and he started writing on my website under the pen name The Centurion. And I still have his writings in my database. And at a point in time, Eben Barlow wrote on my website. I think he's also done lectures, and I think he even has his own blog these days. But he's the longest running white mercenary in southern Africa. You see, a mercenary can only do things that other governments allow them to do. These people only fight for money. They do not fight for principles. And in that sense, Machiavelli was right about mercenaries. Anyway, this guy has fought many wars in Africa. He's even defeated the blacks who were our allies in Angola. He defeated them. He and other whites defeated them using Russian weapons and being paid by communists to defeat blacks. At the moment, I think he's won two wars. He won the war in Angola. He won the war in Sierra Leone. And this guy is currently fighting Muslim terrorists in Nigeria, Eben Barlow. His company is known as Executive Outcomes, and he's written big, thick books on his military exploits. And this is his company. And all those white guys are actually white South Africans. And as long as white men fight for blacks, fight for black communists, or fight for the British, or fight for the Americans, that's okay. The moment that whites try to fight for themselves and their interests, ooh, that's a big no-no. The whites of South Africa, they believe that apartheid is such an evil thing, and they've committed the great crime of apartheid. And yet apartheid is nothing new, and America itself is hypocritical. They had a form of apartheid known as segregation. And there was a sign from the time of segregation, which ended in the 60s. The most successful form of apartheid ever created was actually created by whites who invaded India in 1500 BC. Whites known as the Aryans invaded India and conquered all the non-whites there. And those whites created a religion called Hinduism and a legal system to back up this religion. And in that religion, they basically classified people according to the color of their skin. And so the whites were up here and the non-whites were down here. And Hinduism exists in India to this day. This system allowed the whites of India, the Aryans, to rule the blacks for 600 years non-stop until the whites began interbreeding with the non-whites. But even the resultant colored people If you look at India, you'll see all their upper classes. Their upper classes are light-skinned people, and the darker people are at the bottom. The Hindu caste system, the most successful apartheid in all of history, is actually still in action, and colored people run it. And the Romans and Greeks also instituted apartheid. When Alexander the Great invaded Egypt, Greeks and Romans went on to rule ancient Egypt for 300 years. And during that time, they instituted apartheid. And among the rules that they instituted was that whites from Europe could immigrate into ancient Egypt. It's the reverse of modern-day North America. And if you look in some of the artwork from ancient times, you can see the skin colors are quite evident. And in 2016, they did a scientific study in India, and they came to realize in this scientific study that the caste system and skin color go hand in hand. And to this day. So what did we whites learn from our wars in Southern Africa? Well, we whites were kind of new to the world of power, and we didn't realize that other people out there in the rest of the world wanted our assets. President Nixon of America himself, in his book, The Real War, he says that the Soviet Union's strategy was a race war in South Africa. The Americans know that the communists wanted race war. All these wars in Africa were attempts by the Soviet Union and China to create racial conflict, to pit black against white. Our weakness was perhaps our dependence on cheap black labor. But Nietzsche, the German philosopher Nietzsche, has a concept called the will to power. And he says, the world itself is the will to power and nothing else. And you yourself are the will to power and nothing else. And Nietzsche basically believed that all living things have a desire for power. Whether it's a baby learning to walk, whether it's you getting an education, whether you're trying to earn more money, whatever you're doing, whether you're going to gym, in some way or other, you are striving for more power. And Nietzsche thought that all living things strive for more power. Well, the blacks have had political ideas, junk ideas as well, fed into their heads, and the blacks have changed. The blacks now have a will to power. The blacks will never go back to being our subservient labor in the future. So the blacks don't want to go back. They cannot go back. They've tasted power and ambition. And all that you have now is the conflict that exists is basically nature at work. They want stuff that belongs to us. The communists taught them that everything that is wrong with their lives is because of us. The communists taught them that if they got our things, if they got our houses, our cars, our mines, our farms, that their lives would, that all their problems in their lives would go away. And that's what they were taught, and many of them believe it. And so what the blacks want and what the whites want are diametrically opposed to each other. Winston Churchill, not somebody I like to quote, but Winston Churchill once said, an appeaser is one who feeds a crocodile, hoping that it will eat him last. And in many ways, the whites of South Africa are like that. We are constantly appeasing these blacks. The crocodile is there. There's this black crocodile, and he sees white people on the menu, and he wants to eat them. And we try and tell the crocodile, no, not today, not today. Do something else. But that crocodile, he's going to come and try and eat us one day. So why did the whites of Southern Africa lose? Well, one of our problems was that we became tired of war. We had these low-intensity wars, and it just carried on year after year, and there seemed to be no end in sight. But for the whites of South Africa in particular, peace may have been deadlier than war. Because in the time of so-called peace and black rule, anything from 60 to 80,000 whites have been murdered by criminals. It is in a time of peace, so-called peace, under black rule, that at least 1,500 white farmers have been killed. Those statistics did not exist when we were fighting our enemies. These statistics have only occurred since political solutions. In Angola and Mozambique, the greatest financial and asset losses that the Portuguese experienced were experienced when they had the political solution. In Rhodesia, the greatest farming and economic losses that the whites ever had were under black rule, not under white rule. So, as far as I see it, political negotiation and trying to embrace our enemies and hoping that if we embrace our enemies and we make friends with them, that this is going to lead to peace and prosperity. The whites just wanted to stop the war and go back to the to just living happily and becoming rich again. But I don't think that that is possible, actually. And embracing our enemies and stopping resisting our enemies has been our biggest disaster. It is the politics that has truly brought disaster upon us in ways that we never even conceived. We even lost control of political and military things that we used to dominate completely. When we were fighting, and the Soviets sent shiploads of weaponry, and they came up with all kinds of grandiose plans to destroy us, none of those plans actually worked. We ended up outwitting them, and we ended up, whenever we fought our enemies, we inflicted heavy losses on them, and we did not suffer great military disasters. We never lost a city. We never lost a town. We didn't even lose small towns. We lost none of the above in all those years of conflict. The only genocidal attack that ever took place against whites was in Angola in 1961. And the Portuguese, the lesson of the Portuguese, whereby the Portuguese, when somebody attempted to kill their women and children and genocide their civilians, and they responded in kind by killing the enemy's women and children and civilians. When the Portuguese did that, the blacks immediately stopped. And the blacks never again tried that trick on any of the other whites of southern Africa. Blacks who were our friends. Which blacks were the best friends that we had? Well, we had black Christians who were our allies. We had black liberals who were our allies. And they were useless. Because we spent more time protecting the blacks who were our friends from being killed by the black communists. We had to protect them. The best allies that we whites actually had were actually unexpected. Some of our best allies were ex-communists. They were people willing to kill other people, and they were willing to kill our enemies and to stand by us. And also blacks who were anti-communists and were willing to kill communists, they turned out to be good allies. But Christians and liberals, there are plenty of them around, totally useless. In Africa, brutality is the winner, always. The only useful help that we ever got in all our wars, we didn't get any help from North America, none. Any help that we got came in one form or another from Europe. Whether it was individuals, whether it was businesses, whether it was the odd country that dealt with us, but that was the only help we ever got. And Britain and America definitely were never our friends. They never assisted us, ever. All our failures were really political. And I think that maybe for us, political solutions are impossible. That we expected things from our politicians that actually just weren't feasible. That when what you desire and what your opponent desires is diametrically opposite, there is maybe no political solution. So, finally, for me, one of the most important lessons is that the best people to protect our interests as whites in Southern Africa was ourselves. When we stood up for ourselves, when we looked out for our own interests, when we watched our enemies, when we took action against our enemies, the more we worked on self-reliance, the better we survived. And for me, the big lesson is also teamwork and unity. Even when we argued among ourselves, it didn't matter. The argument itself did not lead to military disaster. We may have argued about the way to do things, but that in and of itself did not bring about disasters. What brought disasters was when we started turning to outsiders, when we tried to befriend our enemies, and when we moved away from doing things. You know, whites are workers, and when we work, whatever we work at, we are successful at. And the same is true for warfare. Whenever we go and we decide to fight somebody, that is like working. It's just another form of working. And when we do things ourselves, we are always successful until we touch this thing called politics. Politics is like this scam, this total, it's almost like magic. And politics never gives a fair outcome. And in fact, if you really study European history, you might find that this is true for other whites as well. That politics has never really been the friend of white people. There are many, many white countries that have fallen to political solutions. They were doing quite well when they were resisting their enemies. So anyway, so for me, unity, self-reliance, and sticking together, those are, for me, the most important lessons from our wars. And that when we believed in ourselves, that gave us the best hope. And our greatest successes and our greatest moments occurred then. Everything else, politics, all nonsense. Thank you very much for listening.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites.